Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Captain David Carroll. Today is 24 February 2012. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Captain Carroll is joining me by telephone from his home in Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey. Captain Carroll, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some biographical information from you, if I could. Can you tell me when you were born and where?
I was born October 13th, 1944, in Plainfield, New Jersey.
And what were your parents' names?
My mother's name was Mary Emily Joyce Bonning Carroll, went by Joyce. My father's name was Morris Burt Carroll, Jr.
And what did they do for a living, sir?
When I was born, my mother was a housewife, and my father was a tool and die maker.
Did you have brothers or sisters?
I subsequently have a sister named Cynthia.
And how old is she in relation to you?
She's 2 years younger than I am.
2 years younger than you, okay. Did you grow up there in New Jersey?
We stayed in New Jersey until I was, I guess about 14, and then moved to Florida, to Holmes Beach, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up settling in Florida permanently, ultimately.
Okay. What was life like for you growing up there in New Jersey?
Well, it was a little different in a way. My parents divorced when I was about 3 years old. In fact, my first recollection of my father, seeing him, actually wasn't probably until my fifth or sixth birthday. I grew up in a very nice, what I call sort of middle class neighborhood in Millburn, New Jersey. That's in Essex County. Single family home that was owned by my grandparents. So my mother, sister, and I were living with my grandparents. They died in 1951, 52, and perhaps again in 1954, 55. And after that, we moved to Florida. I guess it was 1958 we moved to Florida.
Mm-hmm. Your father, was he involved in the Second World War at all?
No, he wasn't. He was. He served in the Army prior to the war. But I think he had as a tool and die maker, he had some sort of, not exempt status, but, critical service work or some such thing.
Sure, sure. Well, where did you go to school?
I went to elementary school in Millburn, and the Washington School in Millburn, and then to the 7th and 8th grade, and a portion of the 9th grade, at Millburn Junior High School. And in January of, what would that have been, 59? January of 59, my mother arranged for me to go to a school called the Church Farm School, which is now called the School at Church Farm, in Paoli, Pennsylvania. It's a school that, at that time, was a boys' school. It's a boys' boarding school. For the sons of single-parent families.
Hmm.
And tuition was very, very minor. I think my mother paid no more than about $200 or $300 a year, and in return, we worked a 2,000-acre farm as we went to school.
That is really interesting. What was the nature of the work that you did there at the school?
I milked more cows than I ever wanted to. I worked the fields, brought in hay and straw, ground oats and corn, slopped hogs, cleaned up after chickens, drove tractors and trucks and, that sort of stuff, what you would do on a farm.
How long were you at the school in Pennsylvania?
I graduated in June of 1962. In fact, I'm getting ready to go to my 50th high school reunion in a couple of weeks here.
Hmm.
It was a small class. There were only eight in the graduating class. The school itself had students from what would be considered the fifth grade through grade 12. And at the time that I was there, there were probably no more than about 100 students in all eighth grade.
What prompted the move to Florida around this time?
My mother had been working since the divorce, doing a number of things. She'd worked in New York, she worked in Newark, and she took a teaching position. She's quite well educated woman, and she took an elementary school teaching position, first teaching job, and had a pretty rough first year of it. And at the end of her year, she was talking with a woman who had been her teacher at the Washington Elementary School in Millburn, who had also been my teacher and my sister's teacher, about it. And the teacher said, well, my sister has a couple of places for rent down in Florida. Why don't you come on down at least for part of the summer and sort of relax down there and, you know, sort of chill out after the year and make some decisions as to what you want to do. And so my mother and sister went down to Florida. I didn't. I had to stay for the summer and work the farm. That was part of the deal at the school. And while she was down in Florida, she stopped by the Manatee County Board of Education and put in an application for a teaching position. She subsequently came back up with my sister to New Jersey. And just before the school year started up here in New Jersey, she got a call from the Board of Education in Florida saying, can you come down here? We have a teaching position in English, Latin, and French at Palmetto High School, and we need you down here right away. So she and my sister headed down to Florida. Hmm. That's how we ended up moving there.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
What was it like for you to move as a 14-year-old boy from up north, as it were, down to Florida? What was that like for you?
It was quite a bit different. It really was. I mean, Millburn, New Jersey, very cosmopolitan town, commuter city for people working in Manhattan. We moved to Holmes Beach, Florida, which is one of three towns on Anna Maria Island, which is the first island south of the mouth of Tampa Bay. Principally a retirement community. There were a few kids my age the few times that I was there that I got along pretty well with. My sister had a much more difficult transition. She's 2 years younger than I. And so she would have been in, I guess, going into the seventh grade or so at that point. And, you know, after having been in a relatively small elementary school in New Jersey and knowing everybody in the class, just sort of being dumped into this county school system now that they had in Florida at the time was a bit of a challenge for her. One of the things that that came out very early on, Florida at that time had a strictly segregated school system, and there was still tremendous vestiges of segregation, whites only, drinking fountains, the beach out at Holmes Beach, for example, was off limits to any black people, and you know, things of that sort. So it was quite a transition, and I had not seen any of that in New Jersey or in Pennsylvania where I was at school.
Hmm. What was your reaction to that as a kid?
Hello, are you there?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to that, to the segregated aspect of life in Florida?
Well, I didn't think it was right. I had black friends in New Jersey, and I couldn't see why why such a system existed. It just didn't make sense to me. My mother's was quite an outspoken liberal. She took great offense at it as well, and certainly, I would hear about it. She bumped into it a lot more than I did, of course, because she was there all the time, and I was just there when I was down on vacation. So.
Mm-hmm. So did you continue to go to school throughout the rest of high school in Pennsylvania?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You finished your education there then?
School there in June of 62.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. What sort of things did you like to do in school, other than, of course, milking more cows than you cared to?
Well, I was on the track team, the basketball team, the soccer team. I captained the track and soccer team in my senior year. Let's see, what else? That was basically it, you know, high school sports and academics. I did reasonably well in both both ventures, I guess.
What sort of academics were you interested in?
Science.
Mm-hmm.
And math and science. Let's see, what did I do? I was given the American Institute of Chemical Engineers Medal for Science in 1961, I guess it was. And that was, I don't know, I think I still have it around here somewhere. That was a nice medal and a certificate. I took, essentially took a second year of high school chemistry, which was really the first year of college chemistry. The school was small enough that chemistry and physics were taught in alternate years.
Mm-hmm.
So I had chemistry in my junior year, my fifth form year, and physics in my sixth form year. And so there was an opportunity to essentially get a second year chemistry instruction.
Doing as well as you did academically, was college going to be in your future for sure?
Yes, yeah, it was definitely going to be in my future, and just a question of where it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I had considered applying for an appointment to Annapolis. I'm not quite sure why I didn't, quite frankly, but I didn't. Instead, I applied around to a number of different colleges and got into, you know, had admission to several. Ended up going to Georgia Tech in Atlanta.
What spurred your interest in Annapolis before we get you down to Atlanta?
Oh, I don't know. I just always been kind of interested. I was interested in naval aviation. From a particularly early stage, I don't know. My mother's cousin was English, was an RAF pilot in the Second World War. So I was interested in aviation through knowing about my so-called cousin Terry, who actually had trained over here in the U.S., married a woman from Georgia. Ended up going back, back and around, I don't know, 1941 or 1942, to fly for the RAF. So, you know, there was that interest in aviation, and I always thought the Navy was a lot cooler than the Army anyway. So.
Right. Well, you seem to have had a number of choices here. What drove you in the direction of Georgia Tech?
At the time, I thought I wanted to be a chemical engineer. And I thought the engineering program there would be good. The tuition for an out-of-state student was pretty low compared to most anything up in the Northeast, and that was a, you know, that was a factor. I mean, my mother was a school teacher, and there wasn't a whole lot of money to pay for school. My freshman year, the tuition was something like $750. yeah.
Good luck finding that today.
Yeah, right. That'll get you through the first month, maybe, if you're lucky.
Maybe, if you don't go out to eat or anything.
Yeah.
Making this transition from the Northeast to the South again, and this time you're 18, 19 years old, how did you find life, society, culture in Georgia? There in the early 60s?
Well, I mean, Georgia Tech, probably three-quarters of the students at Tech at that time came from Georgia, and I wouldn't be surprised if 80% came certainly from the southeast. But it was still relatively cosmopolitan. I mean, Atlanta's a cosmopolitan city. It was priding itself as a city that was too busy to hate.
Mm-hmm.
There were some certainly very progressive mayors of the city during the time that I was there. Ivan Allen was one name that I remember as a mayor in Atlanta. Of course, the civil rights movement was just beginning to be effective, if you will, with Martin Luther King in Atlanta and the SCLC and some of these other organizations. And I'd been quite a faithful Episcopal churchgoer. The church farm school was run by the Diocese of Pennsylvania, so it was a religious-backed school. And there was the Episcopal Church right off campus there in Atlanta was a place to go and to be and see people and associate with people and whatnot. So it was a pretty easy transition for the most part. I had four roommates in the dormitory. We had a double suite, and let's see, one was from Louisiana, one was from Georgia, and two of them were from Georgia. So in some respects, I was kind of an outsider, but we got along fine.
You mentioned the civil rights movement and these various different aspects of it. What do you remember about the civil rights movement and these activities in Georgia in general, Atlanta, of course, and even at Georgia Tech? What was the environment like in regards to the civil rights movement?
I didn't hear a whole lot. I think the University of Georgia had up in Athens, just 70 miles or so up the road, had just integrated, I believe, and maybe the year before. Tech had integrated, and had done so very quietly, without any fanfare or fuss, a year or two before. And I think they had an ongoing program with the Atlanta University Complex, a collection of historically black colleges, Morehouse and Spelman, and I can't remember the others. I think there were three or four that made up that cluster. So there were, there'd been students on campus, I think, for quite a while. The one thing I do recall, Georgia Tech played Navy at home, and this may have been in 1962 or 63, football game, and Someone who I think was a Tech graduate, who was a member of the Georgia House of Representatives, tried to have the game canceled because Navy had a black football player.
Is that right?
Yeah, actually happened. And, of course, the game wasn't canceled, but the president of the university basically said the game will go on, and that was that. So there was never any... I don't think there was ever any serious debate that the game would happen, but mm-hmm. I just recall that as something that it was still those attitudes. And,
right.
And
Another part of the early 1960s, of course, was the presidency of John Kennedy. Mm-hmm. What do you recall about Kennedy?
I recall kind of vaguely some of the campaign, his campaign for the presidency. I was not particularly political, and I don't recall, quite frankly, I don't recall who I preferred, he or Nixon. I do I do remember sitting at my desk doing homework when and listening to the radio when the announcement came over about the assassination.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I had joined an Navy ROTC at Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech was a land grant school, and ROTC was mandatory for all males for 2 years. And so I joined the Navy ROTC. Again, I didn't want to have anything to do with the Air Force or the Army. And I did end up getting switching over from what they call a contract student to a regular, which is how I got my commission. I remember we were to have some sort of, I think it was called the Navy Ball, that coming weekend. And I do remember a bunch of us sort of assembling down at the Naval Armory, which was just down the road from the dormitory that I was living in. And, you know, we're all sort of milling around in there, wondering what the world is happening and what's going on, and just, you know, wondering how in the world this could happen.
You mentioned that you joined the ROTC, Naval ROTC there. What was Navy ROTC like in Georgia Tech in the early 60s?
Well, it was a relatively small, it was the smallest of the three ROTC programs. And I believe it was the most selective of the three also. A combination of physical exams and written exams to get accepted. If you didn't get accepted in that, I think you were pretty much arbitrarily thrown into the Army ROTC program as long as you were physically fit.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a relatively small group. There were maybe 50 of us in the program. Some of the guys, and it was all male at the time. Some of the guys were regular program, had been accepted on a scholarship basis prior to enrolling as freshmen. We had one fellow who was NESEP, Navy Enlisted Scientific or something or other. He'd actually been on active duty as an enlisted, and the Navy was sending him to school, so he was getting a full ride, as well as being, I think, probably an E4 at the time, maybe an E5 at the time. So we were a relatively small group. We had drill day one day a month. There was a small band, and we'd march down to the parade ground and do our stuff on the parade ground and march back, and we'd go right through fraternity row and pretty frequently get jeered from the porches, but we looked pretty sharp in our uniforms, so it wasn't bad.
right. What sort of courses were you taking there at Georgia Tech? What were you going to major in?
I started out majoring in chemical engineering and very quickly switched to chemistry. I had been exempted from freshman chemistry because of what I'd done in high school and because of the SAT advanced chemistry score that I did pretty well on. So I figured I had kind of a leg up on the chemistry program. So I go ahead and do that. I decided I really didn't want to be an engineer. A friend of the family was an executive with a company, and he had been a chemical engineer. And he had sort of interviewed me, if you will, before I'd gone to school, the summer before I started. And, he'd asked me a few questions about things, and I don't recall what they were exactly, but he said, you might be better off in chemistry than chemical engineering, but see how you like it. So it was an easy switch.
Mm-hmm. And how well did you do academically in college?
Not very well.
Hmm.
I had a pretty good time. I took 5 years to graduate instead of 4. So.
Well, that'll happen.
Yeah. But 3 of those years, I was in the regular program, regular Navy ROTC program, and so at least my tuition and books were covered. And, by that point, my mother had moved to Georgia to take a teaching position in Georgia, so I was actually living at home and going to school for the first time in probably 7 years, or 6 years.
And what prompted her move up to Georgia?
It was a teaching position, and my sister at that point had started college in Georgia. She went to Agnes Scott College, which is just outside Atlanta. So I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure what prompted that.
Hmm.
Maybe it was the fact that we were both in school up there. I don't know.
Hmm. Another part of the time, the era in which you grew up, the dominant political issue of the day was, of course, the Cold War in terms of geopolitical issues. What do you remember about the Cold War as a backdrop to your growing up?
Well, I certainly remember the Cuban blockade, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I know a whole bunch of us in the ROTC program were wondering, are we going to war? Are we going to get called up? What's going to happen here? That was very real. In fact, a friend of mine's father, one of my high school classmates' father was in the Navy. He was a master chief down here at Lakeland. I'm sorry, not Lakeland, Lakehurst, the Naval Air Station at Lakehurst, and he was prepared to retire, I remember, at that time, and he was extended on active duty, for quite some time before he was allowed to actually go ahead and retire, all over the Cuban Missile Crisis.
When did you graduate from Georgia Tech?
I'm sorry?
When did you graduate from Georgia Tech?
I graduated in June of 67.
June of 67. What kind of plans did you have for the time that you were going to spend in the U.S. Navy? Was there a particular aspect of the Navy that intrigued you that you wanted to go into? Are you still looking at aviation? Are you looking at sea duty? What are you looking at doing?
Well, I was looking at aviation. The Navy had something called the Flight Indoctrination Program, and it was a way of getting a private pilot's license while, determining whether you were PQ and AA, physically fit and aeronautically adaptable to flight. And so I did take part in that. That was interesting. We flew out of Fulton County Airport, northwest of Atlanta, and trained in a Cessna 150. I got to do that. I wasn't sure what I was going to end up doing when I got commissioned. I had gone through the three summers, the three cruises. My first one was on a destroyer, the North Atlantic. I really enjoyed that, even though I was down in the forward engine room for most of the time. The second class cruise was a mix of trying to get you to go into the Marine Corps.
Is that right?
By going to Little Creek, Virginia, for 3 weeks, and then 3 weeks down in Corpus Christi, and for the aviation side of things. And I really enjoyed the aviation portion of that. Flying in a T-28 or a T-34. Just having a great time. I really enjoyed that. My first class cruise was on USS Columbus, guided missile cruiser, and that was a trip over to Europe, which was pretty neat. And unfortunately, there were an awful lot of midshipmen on that trip, and so there wasn't much of an opportunity to, there were too many people for too few jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to,
right.
to look at it. And although I had a good time, I don't feel that I particularly learned anything. No, I take that back. I guess I did. Prior to getting the trip was to be, you know, as part of a fleet exercise up in the Norwegian Sea, and prior to getting up to the Norwegian Sea, remember we had a briefing from shipboard intelligence officer in the wardroom about what we were likely to see. You know, are going to be overflown. There's going to be AGIs out there. And, you know, it'll be kind of interesting. And he said, and we have some cameras that are up on the bridge. And if anything happens, just feel free to grab a camera and start shooting some pictures for us. So, 4 or 5 days later, we're up in the Norwegian Sea, and sure enough, we get overflown by a recce bear. And everybody's running around like mad up on the bridge. Here's the plane, what's he doing, and blah, blah, blah. And I was the only one to calmly walk over and pick up the camera and start shooting pictures. So I did get a lot of credit for at least being cool enough head to go ahead and do that. So maybe that's the start of my intelligence career.
Huh. Now, you were looking at going into aviation. Obviously, you've got your pilot's license, I would assume, mm-hmm. by the time you left Georgia Tech, and you even went so far, like you said, down to Corpus Christi for training at the Naval Air Station down there. How did you take to flying?
Well, I did not end up going aviation. I'm not quite sure exactly why. I did get married right after graduation. I knew that was coming, and I guess I just decided that I didn't want aviation after all. My first temporary duty assignment was schooling at the Naval Air Technical Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia, down by Brunswick, Georgia. And I went there for the Combat Information Center Officer's Course and the Air Intercept Controller Course. So that was, That was probably about 14 weeks of schooling there. And from there, I was assigned to the USS Pocono, Amphibious Force flagship. So I never did go aviation. The closest that I was to it, I suppose, was as a controller, air intercept controller. And then as an ILO, I had what they call DIFOTEC, duty involving flight as a non-technical observer or something like that. So, and I did do some flying over there, but that was a bit different story.
Tell me about the schooling that you underwent there at Glencoe.
The CIC officer's course was the longer of the two. There were probably, 30 or 35 students, all ensigns, all recently commissioned, and unusually, I found out later, a very large proportion of them were just out of the Naval Academy. Someone had told me in the past, when you graduated and were commissioned from the Academy, you immediately went to a ship before you went to any of these schooling things. But this was apparently some sort of an experiment, and they sent newly commissioned guys directly down to Glencoe. And I was married at the time, my wife was living. My wife and I had an apartment up in Atlanta, because she was working up there, and I would go back and forth on the weekends until the end of the summer of '67, when rental prices went down at the beach,
mm-hmm.
She could come on down and we could find a place down there for a while. So I didn't have a whole lot to do with the guys. I mean, I saw them in class. We didn't socialize all that much, a little bit at the bar after class. But for the most part, on the weekends, I wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
They were, two guys, two other guys in the class are married. What I do recall is the bachelors didn't seem like a particularly mature lot. but maybe that's just what happens when you get out of the academy the first year.
Your first duty on ship was the Pocono.
Right. Uh-huh.
Tell me about this initial time, not the initial time out at sea, obviously, but as an ensign there on the Pocono. What was your duty? What was shipboard life like for you? I would assume this was a two-year tour.
Oop, sorry, you're sort of breaking up here.
I'm sorry. Tell me about your time on the Pocono.
Yeah. Well, I reported, reported for duty, I think, on Christmas Eve. I was immediately assigned into the ops department as assistant CIC officer. The officer complement on the Pocono was pretty big. The commanding officer was a full captain, full four striper. The XO was a commander. All the department heads, as I recall, were all lieutenant commanders. My boss. My boss was a lieutenant commander named Bill Folwick. He was fairly close to retirement, I think, at that point. But anyway, I was one of several assistant CIC officers, and I did find that one of my roommates actually had gone to Georgia Tech also, so I knew somebody on the ship. When I got there, which was kind of nice. Actually, I knew two people on the ship when I got there. Pocono spent an awful lot of time pier side. It was at various times it was the Comfiblant flagship or Fibron 4 flagship, whatever, and it spent a fair amount of time pier side either in Norfolk or if they pumped off enough fuel to float it in and out, it would be over at the amphib base at Little Creek. And it wasn't very pleasant. I didn't like it. It was an old ship. When we were at sea, it had rolled horribly, flat bottom hull, top heavy with radar masts, and it wasn't a very comfortable ship. Very old. It had been built, I think, toward the end of the Second World War. So I like to think now that I've shaved with it many, many times. It's been scrapped a long time ago. The captain was an interesting piece of work, and in some respects, the less said about him, the better. He was a Mustang, had a difficult time with his junior officers. He, perhaps part of it was the times. He had a son that we knew about who was probably one of the earliest flower children. And he couldn't control his son, but boy, did he have the JOs on the Pocono under his thumb.
yeah, I could imagine as a Mustang and reaching that level of command, that must have been something.
Yeah, that was considered a deep draft command, and in fact, the captain before him and the captain after him both had command, their first deep draft command, in preparation for taking over as a carrier command. So, it was kind of an unusual assignment for him in that regard, because he was not going to be. He was not an aviator, obviously, So I spent. We did some traveling. We went down to the Caribbean a couple of times, and we also had an extended stay in the shipyards up in Boston for a pretty complete overhaul. So we were up there for, I don't know, 6 months or thereabouts. That was an interesting time also.
why do you say that?
well, Oh boy, where to begin about that? One of my collateral duties, I was collateral duty intelligence officer, first of all, which is kind of interesting, but I was also the public affairs and welfare and rec officer. At least I was never the mess treasurer. That's my, you know, that's something I avoided completely and successfully. But as the welfare and rec officer, I was responsible for the welfare and rec funds. And right after we got to Boston, the captain wanted to have a car assigned to him from the shipyard, from the stock of cars that they had there. And it was, he didn't get it. It was turned down for whatever reason. I have no idea why. So the next thing I know, I'm called up to the captain's cabin, and the captain and I are going out to buy a car using the welfare and rec funds so that he can have transportation in Boston. So, I'm thinking to myself, is this legal? I assume now it's not, but I'm an ensign. What am I going to say?
Right.
Yeah. So off we go, and we buy a used car, a station wagon. I guess part of the so-called justification is that it's big enough to carry a number of people around, and it's not just a one-person car or something like that. He pretty much commandeered the car, had a driver, and his big old green station wagon would haul him around where he wanted to go in Boston. So, yeah, that was interesting, to say the least.
Tell me about your duties there on the Pocono. You are assistant CIC. You talked about one of your collateral duties was dealing with intelligence. Tell me what your average day was like there. What would you be responsible for in Pocono?
Well, not too long after I came on board, the ship, I don't know what the term is. I guess they activated something called the OI division, which was a kind of a hodgepodge of rates in the ops department, and because it was a command ship, there was a photo lab, there was a drafting shop, and there was a print shop, and a weather shack. So I became the OI division officer, which was good. I mean, I pretty early on I got a division officer's assignment. Mm-hmm. A number of the other JOs on board didn't get that. So I ran that division. I didn't have a chief. I had a first class. I had a leading first class who was a photographer's mate. And so what were we? I guess we were four, seven. 16 guys, aerographers, lithographers, photographers, and draftsmen. Kind of an odd combination of rates on ship, and so that was a good assignment. But otherwise, things were routine watch standing, quarterdeck watches in port, underway. I was always in CIC. I was never up on the quarterdeck, never on the bridge watch. So I did not get qualified as an OOD underway.
Mm-hmm.
There were quite a few junior officers in the deck departments, the captain was an old deck man himself, so that's who, for the most part, stood his watches. If you were in ops, you were in ops, and that's where you stayed.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Did that bother you at all? Did you feel that you were pigeonholed at all?
I'm sorry, you're breaking up again here.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Did that bother you at all, knowing that that's where you were going to stay with ops?
Well, not really. I mean, I had I had qualified as an OOD underway, actually, as a midshipman. That is one thing that I did do on the Columbus. As crowded as it was with junior officers, I did manage to qualify as OOD underway. And at that point, I didn't know whether I was going to remain on active duty or not. My experience with the captain and whatnot being what it was, so I wasn't particularly concerned about it. It was just, you know, there was a lot of talk about that among the JOs in the wardroom, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people not getting a chance to qualify as an OOD. So it was a topic of discussion.
Sure, and something like
not,
that.
Not particularly of concern.
Mm-hmm. It would seem that something like that obviously would limit your opportunities later on. If sea life was for you, then it would be something that would be a little detrimental, I would think.
Yeah, it would have been.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been.
How did you take to sea life, by the way?
Oh, I kind of enjoyed it. I rarely got seasick. but, you know, when you're down in the... when you're down in CIC and you're facing outboard and you're looking at a sweep going around a pea green sweep going around an off blue radar scope, and the ship is rolling back and forth and you're tired, you get seasick pretty quickly.
It sounds like you remember that pretty well.
Oh yeah, I remember that pretty well. But it didn't happen too often.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed life at sea. I didn't have any problem with the watches and getting enough sleep and that sort of stuff. I seemed to do okay that way. I don't remember myself being overly exhausted by being in port and starboard watches, for example. We would do that occasionally underway. I think I adapted to it pretty well.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can tell me what the morale was like, not just on the Pocono, but that as well, but in the Navy in a larger sense. What was the attitude of the enlisted men, the attitude of the officers toward the Navy during this somewhat turbulent time here, 67, 68, 69?
Yeah. I don't know. I remember talking with one of the guys who had been down at Glencoe with me. In fact, one of the academy graduates. He got married very shortly after we left Glencoe, and I remember we would get together with he and his wife up in Norfolk. His name was Chuck Pajewski, if I remember. And we'd talk about sort of current topics in the Navy. One of the hot topics at that point was the Arnheiter affair, what was the Arnheiter affair had to do with essentially an executive officer relieving a captain of command.
Mm.
And ironically, some years later, I was in a Navy reserve unit with a guy who was sent to the ship, and I can't remember the name of the ship now, who was sent to the ship to actually bring it back to the Philippines.
Hmm.
But after the incident that happened. But, we talked about things like that. I don't know, were there other things? Certainly, there was discussion of Vietnam. Not an awful lot. That would have been in 1968, I guess. Some discussion about it. We were on the East Coast. It seemed like a million miles away. Seemed at the time less a Navy issue, although one friend's brother was on the FDR when the Sidewinder went off and killed a bunch of folks. So, things were things weren't necessarily all that distant.
Would you describe morale on board ship as, you know, something positive, something, you say that there weren't an awful lot of issues other than, you know, just kind of Vietnam in the distance and this sort of thing. Did you find that most sailors, whether they were officers or enlisted men, were relatively satisfied with what they were seeing, what they're experiencing in the Navy?
I think the officers in the wardroom, for the most part, were, I don't know, I'd say relatively satisfied. The most of the JOs were had reserve commission, had a minimal obligation, and you know, were going out. That was it. They were not mm-hmm. they were not career people at all, and they seemed satisfied, I guess, with where they were, considering where they might have been had they been in the draft.
Right.
So there was that sort of an attitude. All the guys in the OI division that I was with were, I would say, all of them were career Navy, and they were, for the most part, I think, satisfied with where they were and what they were doing. They were all working in their rate, which was one thing. And for the most part, I think, actually, I guess for all of them, it was a pretty closed rate. So they knew, you know, they had a good sense of where they were going. And I think for the most part, they were okay with shipboard life. They knew that there were good shore assignments for them in the future, and I think that they look forward to that. But they were happy where they were. For example, the PH-1, who was my leading petty officer, for example, had a quite good reputation as a photographer, and had photos in Life magazine and things like that. So he was actually a pretty good role model for the others in the division. So he was, you know, he was particularly helpful. As for the rest of the ship's company, there were issues and problems, and much of it, I think, brought about or certainly exacerbated by the commanding officer. When we were in Boston, for example, in the shipyard, someone had gone over the hill. One of the enlisted guys had gone over the hill, and he was eventually picked up in Corpus Christi, Texas. So he was well outside of the 1st Naval District, and any legal action was supposed to occur, since he was out of the district, was supposed to occur in the district where he was apprehended. And somehow the commanding officer managed to get him transferred back to the ship and immediately slapped him in the brig, put him on bread and water. And I was assigned as his assistant defense counsel. Great.
Great position to be in.
Yeah. Now, and a court was a summary or a special court was convened at 1st Naval District. The presiding officer was my boss, the ops officer, Bill Folwick, and the entire court was officers from the ship. This fellow's defense counsel was an attorney, was a JAG officer, so he had, you know, he had adequate legal counsel. So it was my job basically to run messages back and forth from this guy to the JAG, and actually, you know, function, I guess, as an assistant defense counsel. Well, what happened? The defense counsel brings a motion before the court, again, made up of ship's company officers, This fellow has been denied a speedy trial because this whole thing had been delayed for a very long time with the transfer from Texas to New Jersey or to Massachusetts. And anyway, he'd been denied his right to a speedy and fair trial, and therefore the charges should be dropped. And the court agreed. And with that, the captain confined the entire wardroom to the ship for the remainder of the time in Boston.
Is that right?
Yeah. And, of course, the word of this got around real fast. And all liberty was canceled and, all this kind of stuff. It was really sort of a classic abuse of power. And as you can imagine, the morale on the ship was just in the tank across the board. So that apparently was investigated later on, I was told by one of the officers who remained on the ship after I had left.
And when did this occur?
This would have been sometime in 1968. I don't know, spring of 68, is that about? Spring to summer of 68.
And you continued to have to serve on the ship with the same captain until you left in 69?
Yeah, until I left in 1969. After we left the yards in Boston, we went down to Guantanamo for refresher training, which was another whole incident. But between Norfolk and Guantanamo, I had decided that I was going to grow a mustache. Seemed like the thing to do. I'm 24 years old, or whatever I was. Maybe I'll look a little older and more mature, whatever. So I'm growing a mustache on the way down, and as soon as we pulled into port in Guantanamo, I had the first deck watch, quarter deck watch, and the first official visitor to the ship coming in there was the the commander of Naval Station Guantanamo. So I'm out there in whites, and I've got the long glass under my arm, and I'm anxiously awaiting the car to show up at the pier. And our captain comes down, ready to greet the base commander. And he takes one look at me, and he says, call your relief. What is that growing on your face? Call your relief. So I immediately have to call the next guy up. I'm kicked off the quarterdeck. Well, later that afternoon, the word comes out. There will be no mustaches on the Pocono, period. Now, I'm in terror for my life because we've got guys, old grizzled chiefs, we've got mustaches and whatever. Everybody had to shave their mustaches. So I had some great experiences on the Pocono.
I would think so. Well, how did this incident finally play out?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
How did the rest of this incident finally play out? Number one, did you get any blowback from the enlisted men, from the old grizzled chiefs, like you said? Did you receive any sort of negative feedback over this or blowback?
I was a little worried, quite frankly, because we had we had some people who were pretty damn angry about this.
And did anything come out of this?
No, nothing. Nothing further that I can recall. Eventually, the order was rescinded, but of course, by this time, in some cases, 20 years of good growth was gone.
Did they any sort of disgruntlement, if you will? Was it anything directed toward you, or was it toward the order, or was it toward the captain?
I think it was more toward the order and the captain. I think people fully understood what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly didn't think I was. I don't think anybody thought I was trying to be disrespectful by having 4 days of growth. It was neatly trimmed, but hadn't fully come in yet. So anyway, after we got back from refresher training down there, which was pretty intense, I guess that's always the case. The ship's going through ref tray at in Guantanamo. It wasn't too long after that that one of the amphibious group staffs moved on board Pocono. I guess they'd been over at Little Creek, and they moved the staff onto the ship, and I got to be pretty friendly with the intelligence officer on the staff, and he, in fact, was due for a new assignment. He was going to go up and see his detailer in Washington, so I said, well, maybe I'll tag along with you and go and see the 1100 detailer to get some idea of what I might be looking forward to. He said, well, why don't you talk to the intelligence detailer also, the 1630 detailer? So I did. I talked to both of them. That's essentially how I got the orders to Vietnam. I volunteered when I was there. One of the two, I can't remember whether it was the 1100 detailer or the 1630 detailer, basically described the NILO program in very broad terms, and I said, that sounds kind of interesting. And I realized that a Vietnam assignment would probably be a career-enhancing move,
mm-hmm.
And so that's how I ended up doing that.
Was this the decision to move into intelligence? Was this encouraged by your experiences on the Pocono? Did you think, look, I could get another guy like this on the next ship I'm on?
I don't think it was that so much. It's just something that I guess I got interested in. I was sent to a couple of 1 week or 2 week schools, collateral duty intelligence officer training thing, and it seemed interesting, and I thought it might be a fun thing to do.
So when was it you left the Pocono?
I left Pocono in January of 69.
January 69, okay.
And from there went out to Coronado, for training school around Coronado,
mm-hmm.
Intel training and language school. I ended up briefly in the hospital out at Balboa. So I was delayed several weeks of going over with the guys that were in the training program with me. They got there a couple of weeks ahead of me. So I actually arrived in country the end of July of 69. Yeah, end of July.
Now, you talked to these guys, 1100 and 1630, and you're volunteering for duty in Vietnam, and that's something we haven't talked about yet. What was your understanding of what had been going on in Vietnam? I mean, we're talking about 1969 here, so the war is well underway. The Tet Offensive's in the background. The country's protests against the war are at full steam here. What did you know about the Vietnam War up to that point?
Well, I'd been reading, certainly, I'm a pretty avid reader. I read newspapers and news magazines and that sort of stuff. So, I guess whatever opinions I had were formed by that. There was a neighbor when we lived in Florida. Interesting story here. Three generations. The grandfather had been in Cochin, China during the Second World War. The father had taken part in the relocation of people from the north to the south in 1954, and the son was a major in the Army in Vietnam. So there's, you know, three generations right next door to where my mother was living at the time, who had been there. So I mean, that's a somewhat different perspective of time and involvement, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think I was naive about undertaking something there, and I think I was pretty well informed of what was going on. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was your perception of it? It's one thing to know what is taking place and all of that. It's something else entirely to look at it analytically and say, okay, this is what this looks like, and here's why we're here, and here's how things are going, and here's what the political discussion of this is like, and society's discussion of the war. What about your overall perceptions of the war itself?
I guess my first thought was that the French really screwed things up pretty badly, initially. I don't know. I did view it, in many respects, as a Soviet proxy war, less a Chinese proxy, and in that context, and the overall context of the Cold War, viewed it as this is the current hotspot, and. This is the burr under the saddle that always has to be somewhere, it seems, and it happens to be here now. I hadn't really thought about it until you asked the question.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, well,
kind of an on-the-fly answer.
Well, that's perfectly fine. Here's another one for you. You're married. You got married in 67, you said, when you finished your time there at Georgia Tech. Here it is, 1969. The dominant issue for the United States at the time, it would seem, is the Vietnam War and the a lot of the protest and anger about the war. The war still continues. You are recently married, relatively, and you've just volunteered for Vietnam. What does your wife think of this?
We talked about it before I did anything, and she certainly understood that if I was going to remain on active duty in the Navy, which is at that point what it looked like I would do, this would be a career move. She also understood that there was every possibility that I would get a ship assignment over there anyway. At that point, so on leaving the Pocono, I certainly wouldn't have gotten a shore-based job in the U.S. or anything like that. I would have gone on to a ship assignment, and so there was every possibility that I would be over there anyway. The difference between being ashore and being, outside the 5-mile limit or whatever is something else. But
yes, that was my next question.
Yeah.
It's one thing to say, okay, well, don't worry, I'm going to be on, a Yankee station. I'm going to be nice and safe. But that was not what you volunteered for.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if she had qualms or second thoughts about it, she didn't make them known. She was very, very understanding of what I thought I should be doing to advance So.
All right. Now, you get off the Pocono in January of 69. Do you immediately go to Coronado for training?
Pretty much immediately. We moved some household goods down to my mother-in-law's house, my wife's parents' house, and took a fairly leisurely, 10-day drive from Fort Myers to Coronado, stopping along the way to see some folks.
Mm-hmm. That's quite a drive.
Yes, it is. The interstate wasn't completed all the way through either.
Well, tell me about your time training there in Coronado. This is a whole new world that's opened up for you here.
Yeah.
Tell me about your time at Coronado.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. The training I thought was pretty good. It was run by an Army major and who was an MI branch specialist. There were, I guess, about a dozen of us in the class, and I think we got a pretty quick and abbreviated area studies officer course out of it. I think the best way to describe it. The language training that followed, 10 weeks, I guess it was 10 weeks of Vietnamese language training. That was pretty intense. It was fun. It was interesting. It was hard to pick up a foreign language when you're in your 20s. But it was a good time. I enjoyed the time there. The other thing that was going on, actually, at Coronado at that time was there were hearings on the Pueblo.
Mm-hmm.
That was going on, actually. I think it was in the same building, as I recall. Whether it was a board of inquiry or a court-martial, I don't recall which, but something involving the Pueblo was going on out there at the same time. The guys that I was with out there were certainly an interesting bunch. Quite a few of them were AIs. They'd already gone through training in Pensacola, I think. Everybody had at least one prior fleet assignment of some sort, so there were no newbies there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a nice group of guys. I think we all got along quite well, and were supportive of each other.
You said that a big part of this was something similar to an area studies kind of course. Tell me about the courses that you were taking there at Coronado in preparation for this.
Well, there was a lot of stuff on process. The intelligence process as a whole, the whole idea of collection, evaluation, dissemination, and display, or I think that's what it was. We did a fair amount of work on mapping, for example. Some PI work was done. We had weapons training. And, of course, we all went through survival training together.
If you don't mind, and if you can, I realize this was a very long time ago, take me through each of these steps, whether it was the PI training, the survival training, the language training. Take me through these in as much detail as you can remember, please.
Well, start with the language training. In some respect, that's the freshest. We were... we were small groups of maybe a dozen students that met, I guess it was probably six hours a day, 5 days a week. We had a native speaker who ran the class. As I recall, they were all young women, and all young Vietnamese women. And there were assignments. Most of the stress was on speaking, on the spoken language, not the written language. But and we started out with, as I guess you probably do with most modern language training nowadays, a lot of conversational related things first. You know, greeting people and asking questions about surroundings and that sort of thing. And I think mostly the difficulty for me at least was trying to understand the spoken language as spoken by a native speaker at, you know, the standard, this is the way I talk kind of clip.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking the language itself, there were certainly plenty of drills in doing that, and it was, you know, the old case, if your mouth doesn't hurt, you're not doing it properly until you've developed these other muscles. But and so in the class setting itself, there was a lot of student-to-student interchange. You know, you were talking with your partner, having a conversation with your partner, as the Vietnamese instructor was trying to correct each of you as you spoke. So that, I'd say that was pretty intense. I that's probably the most intense learning experience, because you know, you're trying to cram, an entire vocabulary into your head in pretty short order. I don't know how much of it is stuck. I can still look at a menu in a Vietnamese restaurant and have some sense of what I'm ordering, but that's about it. Now, as far as the PI training, for example, was concerned, I won't say that there was a formal curriculum to it. It was more of a sort of a hands-on thing, just taking some representative imagery and trying to be able to, you know, to read it properly, to look at shadows, to determine, you know, the angle at which something was taken, and you know, what that meant, and so forth. So I imagine that I can only imagine that a formal PI course would go into an awful lot more theory early on before actually getting you into the process of trying to read imagery and to do something from it, but that's basically what we did. It was sort of a crash course in that.
What kind of photos would they show you? What sort of images would you see and have to interpret?
It was all handheld. I shouldn't say that. There was some. I think there were some strip negatives, you know, from aerial camera. Certainly no satellite stuff at that point. So.
Sure. What sort of images themselves were they show you?
It was all local stuff for the most part. I mean, there were some shots from Vietnam. There weren't very many. I didn't think, but there was a lot of locally taken imagery. So we saw some stuff, some shots from the Delta, and some stuff from probably from up in I Corps. But as I recall, that was basically it.
All right, another part of this training here at Coronado is going to be survival training. And this is something that is always interesting, and people's take on it is quite broad and varied in a lot of different ways. Tell me about survival training.
It seems like there were maybe 60 of us that went through at one time. Perhaps even more. I don't know. We're quite a few. It was done at Warner Springs. I know there were some guys that were actually taken up to Washington State for theirs, but we went through at Warner Springs. I don't know, I thought the experience was interesting. I got slapped around a little bit, and I didn't get waterboarded, I got knocked around a bit. Most of the group going through with me, most of the group were enlisted. The senior officer, as I recall, was an older gentleman. I think he was an LDO, lieutenant commander, and he was going over, he was in the language class with me, and he was going over, he was scheduled to go over to the advisory group, probably in Saigon, and but he was the senior officer of the group going through survival, and he got pretty well pounded on. I must say he to all outward appearances he was he held it together and tried to during the camp phase tried to I think as well as he could to try and maintain some semblance of order among the rest of us. My one memory of it is, after being captured, after going through the E&E portion and getting snagged up in a tree, here I am standing in the camp. I've got a black blindfold over my head, and there was a small pinhole in the blindfold, and I had a very narrow field of vision out of this thing. You just imagine looking through something that's maybe an eighth of an inch hole to try and look through. So I'm twisting my head around to try and get some sense of where I am, and I was standing right next to a shelf. There was a almost like a little workstation there. And on the shelf was a bowl of oranges. And so I, do as much of a 360 as I can and snake my hand out and grab an orange and drop it into my pocket. And, fully expecting that I'm going to get slapped up the side of the head. Well, nothing happens. So at one point when they're hauling some of us away to put us in the little boxes, to crunch over and get in the boxes. Well, I ended up in a box that was just a little bit too big for me, so I had room to move around. And as an act of defiance, I ate the orange in the box and left the peels there. So I got slapped around a little bit for that.
If you don't mind, Captain, take me through the daily pace and routine of the survival training. What was it, like 5 days, something like that?
I think we were out, the first day we were on the beach at Coronado, trying to make barnacle soup or something. It was just a cold night on the beach. Mm-hmm. That's what I remember. They loaded us up in trucks and took us up to up to Warner Springs. Did we spend the night in tents? I think we may have spent the night in tents. Anyway, the next day, there was talk about survival things and, examples about Dieter Denger and escape and evasion and, what to look for in the way of edible things and so forth. And then there was the actual E&E portion of it, which, as I recall, was, maybe an afternoon or something like that. They let us loose, and we had to try and make it to Freedom Village while we're out there searching for you. And, of course, everybody got captured. I think that was built into the scenario. That was late in the afternoon, and that's when I managed to swipe the orange. I think the actual camp phase, as I recall, was really just overnight and it ended the next morning, as I remember.
Hmm.
I don't remember it being a full week. Maybe it was, but I don't recall that.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Dieter Dengler. They were already using his experiences as something to learn from at this time, even.
Yeah.
They're in 69. Hmm. Very interesting, very interesting.
Yeah.
What other kinds of training did you undergo here? Weapons training, for example, you did mention that. What sort of weapons were you being trained on?
We're being trained on the M16 small arms, 45, 38 Navy Special. We also got some time with an M60 and an M79. That was close to 4 days worth of that, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That was up at Pendleton. Did that up at Pendleton. I guess we were gone about 4 days on that one.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, you know, everything from, field stripping to taking it all the way down to nothing to cleaning to, you know, reassemble and whatnot. So that was, that's, when you start shooting, it started to feel a little bit more, pucker factor went up.
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, especially for a guy who was Navy ROTC and mm-hmm. spent the first 2 years on the Pocono to be out there running around and, like you say, trying to find a way to make barnacle soup
right.
or whatever it was, to
yeah.
field stripping weapons, and it's mm-hmm. a whole new Navy that you're in right now.
Yeah, a whole new Navy. It was fun. I think all of us who went through it enjoyed it. I think we were all young. We're all bulletproof. Yeah.
Right. So do you feel pretty good about yourself and about your training when you leave there, Coronado?
Yeah, I did. I felt that I had a good package to go with. I wasn't sure where I was going to end up either. My orders were to go in as Assistant Coastal Zone IO out at Antoy. Because of the delay for my being in the hospital, I wasn't there, I wasn't in country to do that, which in retrospect I'm quite happy about, because as a result I did end up with an ILO assignment instead of the assignment out in Antoy at the Coastal Surveillance Center.
Mm-hmm. You did mention this illness. What was physically? What was wrong with you?
I had developed something called a pilonidal cyst, and which is a rather nasty cyst in a rather nasty place. And I had to go in. In fact, I was in language class when the thing literally erupted, and so I had to go in for an operation at Balboa, and. I was held there for about a week post-op, and then couldn't do anything physically for another couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what held me back.
Right, right. Well, Captain, I think we're probably at a pretty good place to take a break for today.
This is Kelly Craig.
I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
No, you go.
I was going to introduce the interview session. Today is 6 March 2012. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Captain Carroll is joining me by telephone from his home in Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey. All right, Captain Carroll, we were talking off the phone a minute ago, or off the recorder a moment ago, about SEER training and the fact that you did undergo some waterboarding as part of the SEER experience. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Personally, I wasn't waterboarded. I was observing waterboarding. So I don't know if I said that in the questionnaire or not. But actually, I wasn't waterboarded. The we were in the evasion phase of SEER, and what I recall is being captured, hiding out in a tree, which probably wasn't the best place to be. And was rounded up with a group of others who had been trying to make it to Freedom Village, and I was the only officer in the group, and one of the junior enlisted guys was singled out and was waterboarded, and what I recall is protesting pretty vehemently his treatment. You know, it was contrary, I thought, to the convention, and on and on and on, and getting slapped around a little bit for it. But watching this young guy get waterboarded, it didn't last very long, maybe just a few seconds, but it certainly was pretty graphic. His response was pretty much what
I would imagine so. Yeah. Now, you said that you raised a protest here. Now, was this something that you think you would have been expected to do? You know, should you have been captured in Vietnam, and should you have seen someone else being tortured in this kind of way? Did you think that the people who were running the program there, the SEER program, expected you to protest?
I don't know.
Since you're an officer.
I didn't really think about it that way. I just thought it was what I should do. Try and use whatever position I had to stop it.
Right.
Now I doubt that what I said stopped it, but it didn't last very long anyway. But still, the guy was in pretty bad shape when they let him up.
Can you describe that scene for me?
About all I remember about it was that it was out in the open and. In a field not far from the tree that I had been snagged out of. There were, I don't know, two or three captors. That's really about all I remember about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just the fact that it happened.
Right. All right, that's very interesting. I wanted to get that on record if we could have. Now, when we left off last time, we also had you getting ready to go to Vietnam. Now, you were married, you had a family. This is 1969. The Vietnam War is on everybody's mind, it would seem, at this time. But it seems that you didn't really have any sort of reservations to speak of about going to Vietnam. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'd say that's correct. I really didn't have any reservations about it. At that point, I wasn't sure if I was going to make the Navy a career. You know, 30-year career, and so certainly one of my motivating factors was that it was probably a career move to go. So whether I chose to remain on active duty or not, at least in a sense have that ticket punched. I guess that's one way to look at it.
Sure. Well, describe that trip over to Vietnam for me.
Well, my wife and I left San Diego to drive back to Fort Myers, Florida, which is where her mother, where she grew up, and she was going to go back and stay in her mother's house while I was gone. And remember, we packed up the car, and in about 46 hours or so, we drove to Fort Myers. It was a straight-through drive because I had to be back in at Travis Air Force Base. I only had about a week to get across country and then get back across country. So it was pretty intense trip across. I got to Travis, flew into San Francisco, and there was transportation that was available there to get you out to Travis. And I checked in for my trip over. I ran into one other guy that I didn't realize would be there. I thought he was going out the day before. He had missed his flight the day before because he'd spent too much time at the bar at Travis. Anyway, we flew over together into Honolulu, and then from Honolulu to Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, and then from there into Tonsonut. The plane was jammed. I remember it was a Braniff Airlines charter. Braniff at that time was a real colorful airline. I think they were headquartered in Houston, if I'm not mistaken. There were Texas-based aircraft, or airline. And the planes were all very colorful. They had them all painted up on the outside, not these staid-looking silver aircraft. And I remember the flight that I was on was, it was a 707, and the tail was painted yellow. And we all figured, gee, what an appropriate color to be flying a Vietnam plane. We got to Tanzanut and checked into the Annapolis BOQ, or BEQ, B-O-B-E-Q. They were not too far from the from Tanzanut. And I guess it was the following day. They gave us basically about a day to try and get our clocks adjusted. From there, I went down to Vietnam, VNN, you know, headquarters in Saigon, and started. I wasn't sure what my job was going to be at that point, because, as I mentioned earlier, I was delayed for some time going over because of hospitalization. And anyway, I didn't know where I was going. The only thing I knew that I didn't want to do was end up with an assignment in the advisory group. I didn't want to be anybody in the advisory group to the Vietnamese Navy. So
why was that?
I don't know. I'd heard people talking about it and, you know, comments out of court. It's just not something that I wanted to do. Among other things, I didn't think I had the language down enough to do it. That was part of it. But it just seemed like it would be an administrative type thing. I could ride it. I ride a desk in Norfolk as well as I could in Saigon.
Right. So when you get your new set of orders here, I assume it happened the second day.
Yeah, it was either the second or third day. The fellow that I replaced, a fellow by the name of George Baldwin, was due to leave country about 10 days after that. And so I ended up with the assignment to Mito down in the Delta IV Corps as the NILO for Mito, Naval Intelligence Liaison Officer Mito. And I believe George came to Saigon to pick me up. He came up to Saigon to pick me up. And we drove back down. It was, an hour and 20 minute or so drive, not too terribly far from Saigon. Miles, a world away, but not all that far away.
Right.
I spent the next week with George, meeting his contacts there, just getting the lay of the land, and trying to figure out where I was. His trying to explain to me what he thought the job was all about. Who he dealt with, what kind of routine he went through, just trying to get a 1 week familiarization. It worked out, I think, reasonably well. I think by the time he left, I was a bit insecure, but I wasn't entirely insecure. I had some sense of what the job was about. Felt reasonably confident that I could go forward.
Well, let me ask you, before you met with the guy you're going to replace, what was your perception of what a NILO was supposed to do? Now, this is before you get involved and you find out the nuts and bolts of it. When you were on your way, you get your orders there in Saigon, and before George picks you up, someone says, okay, you're going to be NILO Mito. What was your concept of the job?
Well, my view was that I was going to be essentially trying to provide intel support for whoever was there that needed it. I mean, it was basically a kind of a carte blanche to deal with whoever could provide something useful to somebody else. In other words, be a conduit for for stuff that might not get from A to B very directly. The forces in Mito, there were a number of groups in Mito. The River Division 53, PBR Division, was there. There was a deployed platoon from SEAL Team 2 there. That was it, basically, for the Navy side. And then, of course, the naval support activity that provided all the support for the boats and living accommodations and food, you know, those that sort of stuff. The Army had a fairly significant, a very significant presence there. The 3rd Brigade of the 9th Infantry Division was just out at Dong Tam, which was out to the west, which is a large facility. There was an advisory group to the 7th Arvin Division that was actually in the town of Mito. And then there was the the sector, they called it, the sector advisory group, was basically advising regional forces and providing assistance to civilian government there within Mito. So there was a pretty substantial U.S. presence, at least when I got there. Within a short time of leaving, the 9th Infantry Division left, and you know, so all of a sudden we went from about, I don't know, maybe 3,500 U.S. down to, maybe 100, 150. It was a pretty substantial change. But each of those each of those Army organizations had an active MI group. Oh, and also, I'm sorry, I forgot, there was a detachment from the 525th MI group that was also there in Mito. So there were a number of Army contacts that I had that were, you know, interested in collecting stuff that was of interest to the Army that might or might not be of any interest to the Navy. And so I saw pretty early on that my role would be to try and get the information, you know, whatever information the Army had that was useful to the Navy, and get that, you know, be a conduit for that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I guess over a relatively short period of time, I managed to continue the connections that George Baldwin had inherited from whoever he replaced. I'm not sure who it was. There was some continuity there. I think I was, if I'm not mistaken, I was the 3rd Nilo Mito.
Now, Baldwin picks you up. He tells you about what he's been doing as Nilo there at Mito. What does he tell you about the operation that he has set up, about the people, about the forces, about the intel network? What does Baldwin tell you when you arrive?
The first thing he tells me is he's glad to be going back to Seattle, where his wife's a teacher. So that's what he wanted to do. He told me that it was. He said it's interesting. You're gonna meet some interesting people. You're gonna meet some people you don't like. There are gonna be people who are jealous of the position that you have, because of the independence that you have, and you're going to have to learn how to manage that. That was probably the best piece of advice he gave me. He was very open. I mean, he basically said, "Okay, here's what I do every day," and that's what we did for about, as I say, for about a week, very accommodating, and introduced me to a whole variety of people, a whole raft of people that I had to that he thought I should be maintaining contacts with, I think that, you know, that whole process went pretty smoothly.
Mm-hmm. And And this was about a week, you say?
About a week, yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, now, when you get down to the Mito area, can you describe, first of all, describe the geography, the lay of the land? What kind of environment would you be working in physically?
Mm. Well, Mito itself was a pretty large city. I guess it was the second largest in the Delta after Kanto. Flat. I mean, it's, you know, this is all rice paddy area. It's just below the plain of reeds. Dintung Province was a fairly large province up on the Mito River, which is the northern branch of the Mekong, actually. Bordering it across the top, across the north, is the plain of reeds. The Grand Canal is up there, which is at one time, I guess, was a major east-west waterway out of the western part of Vietnam toward the toward Saigon. The city itself is kind of disheveled. There had been pretty severe fighting there in 68, during Tet of 68. There was still, you know, certainly some obvious damage. A lot of old houses, though. There've been certainly an old French colonial presence there, and I guess the largest buildings were maybe three stories at most. A lot of old architecture. It was kind of pretty in a way. I mean, you could see that. You know, had there not been a war going on, it might be very pretty. It might be very pretty to go there now. I've actually thought about that. But the geography was just plain flat and wet. So I got there in the dry season. Yeah, I got there in the dry season. So it was hot, and it was humid, and it was dusty. But the rains came not too long afterwards. So, and there was also. There was an odor, there was a smell. I mean, it smelled different. It didn't smell like Holmes Beach, Florida, or Atlanta, Georgia, or any other place that I've been. So it was an interesting place. There were people scurrying around all over the place.
And tell me about the people that you encountered there. This is, again, very, very foreign for you here.
Yeah, I was very foreign. I had an interpreter-translator, who came along with the job. She was a young Vietnamese woman. Lê Thị Thung was her name. And, I guess she was about 23, 24 years old. She was, her English was excellent. She spoke French, Vietnamese French, and a couple of Chinese dialects. So her family was actually quite wealthy. Her father was a farming machinery importer, as best I could tell, that and motorcycles. And she had been educated. She had a very strict formal education process, and in fact had even spent some time in France. So that certainly made it a lot easier to deal with Vietnamese, who are actually quite afraid of her in many respects.
I wonder why that would be. Just the intimidation because of the language, or
I think combination of the language and her position, I suppose. I mean, here she was. She had this, you know, position as an interpreter, which and she was always elegantly dressed, and I think she probably let it be known that her family quite wealthy. I often wonder what happened to her after 1973. I really wonder what happened to her. So,
what about the rest of the people in the area? How were you received by them? What was their pace of life? What was, just describe for me the locals, if you will.
Right after I got there, the whole process of Vietnamization took hold, I guess, in Mito. And the River Division 53 was essentially being transferred over lock, stock, and barrel to the Vietnamese Navy. The Commodore, I guess that's what they called him, Commodore, he was a captain in the Vietnamese Navy. I had very little dealing directly with him. I mostly had dealings with some of his more junior officers, some lieutenants and lieutenant commander, all of whom spoke English quite well, all of whom seemed to be afraid of my interpreter. All of whom were quite friendly. Didn't make me feel like an interloper in any way. As time went on, over the roughly, I guess it was roughly 10 and a half months or 11 months that I was there, they became more and more remote as the U.S. presence got less and less. Mm. And I found myself spending less and less time working with them. I met very few Vietnamese Army personnel. Most of the ones that I did come across were those who were working either for the S2 at the sector level or the G2 at the 9th. Seventh Infantry Division Advisory Group, I had really very little dealings with them. I did have two principal agents who ran the two networks, and my dealings with them were always pretty good. They didn't speak a tremendous. Their English wasn't all that great, and so I had to rely on the interpreter quite heavily for communications. But they were a friendly group. Two guys. They were actually petty officers in the Vietnamese Navy, and so they were essentially principal agents and ran the networks under them. They took to tasking quite well, and they certainly produced a lot of information. I don't know how much of it would be considered intelligence, but certainly it was information.
Okay, now Baldwin brings you down to Mito, and he's trying to get you set up. And like you said, he takes you through the daily grind, if you will. And I want to get into that in a moment. But describe the facilities you encountered when you got to Mito. I mean, the place where you would be working, the people, the personalities, how the administration was set up down there. Describe all of that for me, please.
Okay. I was a tenant at the Naval Support Activity Detachment. And NSAD Mito was really three separate physical facilities. There was a building that was a barracks, if you will, or I guess at one time it might have been an apartment building or something. Anyway, that's where my rack was. I had a bedroom there, as did quite a few other people. I had my own room. It was quite nice. Across the street, or sort of around the corner and across the street, was a place called the Victory Hotel, which I guess at one time actually was a Vietnamese hotel. That's where the administration was. That's where there was a sick bay there. There was a mess. There was even a small officers' club, if you will. It was set up in a looked like a connection, several Connex boxes, but. Anyway, that's where the admin for Mito detail was. Then down Waterside, next to the Vietnamese Navy base, was the pier facility and the repair facility, and that's where my office was. That was, I don't know, a 10-minute walk away, something like that. It was right on the water. There were, there were two piers, I guess, that came out. They were, they were temporary piers, floating piers, if you will. And the River Division 53 was headquartered down there. And there was a large comm shack, that's where my office was also. I guess at the time that I got there, the staff, the support staff for NSAD METO consisted of, there was a commanding officer whose name was Bill McNicholas, as I remember. His XL, a fellow named Doug Naylor. There was a hospital corpsman, I remember, Doc Neely. A small admin staff that went along with that. Everybody else, I think, was a tenant command of some sort. The group from SEAL Team 2 was over in the hotel with me, or that billet with me. They had the top deck and the roof, and I was on the floor below them. That was it.
All right, now you've got this setup here, and you come in, you've shaken all the right hands, and you know all the right people at this early stage in the game, and Baldwin's going to take you out for a week before he leaves. So if you can, please take me on that week. I mean, spare none of the details. I mean, because all of this stuff is very, very, it's fresh, it's new, and you've got to absorb an awful lot before you take this over in a week.
Right.
So
yeah.
I'm hoping a lot of this stuff stuck in your memory so you can share it with me.
Yeah, I guess quite a bit of it did. The closest place to the office, okay, the one down at the pier, was the sector headquarters, and that was sort of out the gate and sort of diagonally off to the west. And so I think that may have been the first place that we went. The province senior advisor. I was introduced to the province senior advisor. I remember his name very well. It was an unusual name. His name was Joy K. Valerie. Joy Valerie. He was an infantry colonel. He'd been in Vietnam for quite a while. His wife was living over at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, and he would get back and forth fairly often. But he was a permanent fixture there almost. If you were to look up Joy K. Valerie in the Army, you'd find that he charges across northern France with Patton. his XO, I don't remember his original XO, but a new one came in very shortly after I got there, who had an MI background. He was not an MI branch, but in fact, he was fresh from an assignment at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. The S2 was an Army captain, and he had a first lieutenant working for him, as well as quite a few Vietnamese personnel, Vietnamese Army personnel. I don't remember his name, either of their names, but they were extremely helpful. They basically made their office available to me if I, for anything. I could ask them any question. If I was unsure about anything, I could usually count on getting a straight answer from them, or get pointed to the right person or whatever. They were extremely helpful. Also over at the S2 over at Sector, George took me over to the Phoenix office. Which was run by a lieutenant colonel, a major, who was originally from Germany. his first name was Wolf. Anyway, he was the Phoenix advisor, and his office, he had a fairly substantial number of people working for him over there, he had a lot of info, he had a lot of stuff, and so I didn't work all that closely with him, but I did get a fair amount of information from him, and I think we had a pretty good relationship. As I recall, the second place that we went was over to the 525MI group. That was over on the other side of town, and the MI group was actually a pretty large group. There was an Army major, first name Jerry, I can't remember his last name, there, who had a couple of officers two NCOs working for him as case officers. It was a fairly large group. I guess there probably were 8 people there altogether. I think George's best relationship that he had established during his tour was probably with the 525 MI group, and I felt very welcome there. I relied on them quite a bit as the year went by. From there, we went next door to Embassy House, the CIA facility in Providence, and there were some pretty interesting people there. The advisor to the PRU was there. At that time, I think he was a senior chief. He eventually became a master chief. His name was Al Healy with SEAL Team 1. He was really happy to see another Navy person that would come by and visit, because no one from over at the Naval Support Activity really had much to do with him, except for the, of course, for the platoon from SEAL Team 2. The final place that I went in town was over to the advisory group to the 7th Arvin, and there'd been kind of a rocky relationship, I think, for a while with the NILO and the 7th Arvin G2 staff, advisory staff, the U.S. side. Let's see how to describe this. There's where I think there was most, if there was any resentment at all at somebody's independence and freedom to move and talk to whoever they wanted to talk to and whatnot. I think that's where it came from. That was much more of a, I'll call that a straight line Army staff kind of mentality that seemed to take over. You sought permission up, and you granted permission down, and you didn't act particularly independently. And so I think there was a sort of a philosophical conflict there.
Plus your Navy as well.
To make matters worse. So, right. At the time that I got there, I was a junior grade lieutenant as well. The advisor, the senior guy in the G2 office, was had been selected for major, so he certainly didn't want to look at an O2 as a peer.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some I sensed some quite a bit of resentment there. Actually, I was promoted very shortly after that to. O3, I got a spot promotion to O3, and George was an O3. George Baldwin was an O3 already. So maybe there was a view that somehow this position was grading down, and yet it was still supposed to be a liaison position with this up-and-coming major. So that relationship was not particularly good.
All right, now George has introduced you around, and you've been to the Phoenix office, you've been to the 525th MI, you've been to the CIA, you've been to the 7th Arvin Advisory Group. You've already explained the setup, I guess, of the hierarchy for the Vietnamese that you're going to be dealing with. George says, okay, day one, after you've met these people and been to these places and seen where what you need to see there in town in My Tho, is that, does he say, hop in a Jeep and we're going to go around and I'm going to show you things? Did it work that way?
Yeah, that's what he did. We traveled around, went out to Dong Tam, for example, out to the base out there. There was a pretty substantial Navy presence out there. That was, in fact, that was the, let's see, there was a captain out there. That was CTF 117, was it, I think? Was actually out there? Yeah, the Commodore was out there. And there was a quite large group out there. Of course, as well as the as well as people from the 9th Infantry Division, who George took me to meet the people in the G2 office out there as well. Sat in on some of the briefings and that sort of stuff. But I didn't see any issues particularly there, like I did with the 7th. Advisory team. We went out there. We went out to some of the province or some of the oh come on, what are they called? My Tho was the provincial capital. I'm drawing a blank here.
Probably going out to the districts, meeting
the district chiefs. Kai Lei and Kai Bay and places like that. We drove out to those. Highway 4 ran through the province from Saigon down south to Canto. And so we went out, drove out through the province to stop off at some of these little district facilities. Folks out there. George, I don't think, went out there very often, but he was very good at, you know, at taking me out there and at least introducing me to people who were there. Let's see, at the same time that he was leaving, the Nilo who was out at, where was it, Sadek? He was leaving the country also, and I think his name was Nick Carbone. And
mm-hmm. I'm familiar with that name. Yeah.
Yeah. So I met Nick. Wait a minute. Did we? I think we went. Yeah, we went down to Ben Tre, which was down the province down south. That was a ferry ride across the river, and met the Nilo there at the time. And I don't recall his name. He was replaced by, I think Jay Foster replaced him. Went out to Gokong, which is out to the east, a small province out to the east. And what was the name of the Nilo there? He had been through training with me and had come over earlier. I can't remember his name. Yeah. Anyway, he was a Nilo at an army facility and or with the sector group there. There wasn't any other Navy presence out at Gokong, and so he was he was kind of a fish out of water in some respects out there.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Corcoran, I think that was his name.
Okay.
So yeah, this in 1 week, I mean, we put a lot of miles on the vehicle and saw a lot of people. Little difficult trying to keep it all sorted out.
Do you have to take notes on these kind of things, or just expect that you'll remember?
I think I took some notes. I don't know whatever happened to my notes. They probably all got shredded at some point before I left.
What about the Vietnamese contacts? Does George take you around and say, okay, here is someone that we talked to, here's someone who can provide intelligence on these types of matters or in this area? Does he introduce you to the Vietnamese population, would take you to the villages to talk to the people who things might be useful for you? Does he do that sort of thing as well?
No, I don't recall him doing that. The contact that I had was usually through the Americans for whom those people worked, or to whom those Vietnamese spoke. For example, the guys in the S2 office, the ones who dealt with 525 or things like that. So I met them through Americans, but not directly.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
All right. Now again, you've got to take over this substantial position here as Nilo in Mi To. What kind of advice does George offer you as you're traveling around? I mean, just the common things. I mean, whether it's, okay, here's what you have to do to keep your things dry when you're out. Here are the types of ways you deal, the way you interface with the Vietnamese when you talk to them. What kind of advice or information is he providing along these kinds of lines?
Well, the first thing that he told me to do was be skeptical of anything that the interpreter told me. That was the first thing. But I don't know. Other than that, don't really know. Z. I don't really recall. Quite frankly.
Well, that's obviously fine. You mentioned the interpreter, of course, being a little suspicious of what the interpreter might say. Can you give me a little bit more about that, and then how what your view of your interpreter was?
As I say, most of the Vietnamese seem to be very afraid of her, so she seemed to wield some sort of ungranted powers over certainly over the Vietnamese Navy personnel that were down on the down by the river, down by the base of the river. She was certainly friendly enough. She would give advice. Things like, oh, you should maybe talk to so and so, and things like that. So she was helpful. She'd been in that position, I suppose, for a couple of years at that point. So she'd been, she was the continuity, if you will, in that position. She was useful. Actually, she did put me in touch, now that I think about it. She had me in touch with, directly in touch with some of the staff of the 7th Arvin G2, which turned out to be useful at the very end of the tour. I think we all were a bit suspicious of everybody's loyalties, given the nature of the conflict.
Did you trust? No, please go ahead.
Yeah, I for example, I often wondered to myself, how does one become a wealthy industrialist in Vietnam, which is apparently what her family was, her father was. Who does he deal with? Is this all political? All political within the current regime? And I'm suspicious a little bit about the 7th and the 7th Arvin. I mean, group that what was it in 65 or whatever it was fomented the overthrow of the government and things like that.
Right. Now, did you trust that she was giving you the straight poop, if you will? You were saying to her, tell these people this, and then they would respond. Did you feel that part of the relationship between the two of you was solid, or did you have your suspicions about that as well?
Well, I think I always had my suspicions about that, and unfortunately, my, you know, my grasp of the language wasn't such that I could really really be certain of what was being passed on. Either way, I mean, on either side of those conversations that she would have with them in my presence. In the case of the two principal agents, they did try to speak English if they could. I mean, they tried to make themselves understood. And so there were some times where what I thought they were trying to tell me, they would try to tell me in English, and then they'd have a quick conversation with her in Vietnamese. I wasn't entirely sure that, you know, that the translation that I was getting matched my understanding of their broken English, you know, if you know what I mean.
So, sure. Yeah. Tell me about the enemy strengths that you encountered there in the Delta. What were you led to expect from the Viet Cong?
Well, the you know, following Tet of 68, I mean, that was a disastrous defeat, if you will, for the VC militarily,
mm-hmm.
of course. But so things were somewhat quiet for the most part, at least early on. Things were fairly quiet, I'd say, toward the end of 1969. There were on the river, there were relatively few firefights. Boats transiting, you know, they might get the occasional B-40 fired from the riverbank somewhere, but there would not be. There weren't any of the sort of pitched firefights of the kind that were seen in 67 and 68. On the ground, there was relatively little fighting also in the Delta at that time. It began to pick up a little bit, I suppose, after the 9th Infantry Division left. But these were sort of sporadic firefights that, you know, just, as I recall, were you know, started and were done in a matter of minutes. I mean, they were very, very brief, very, very brief firefights. The SEAL team that was there had relatively little action, and in fact, probably, I don't know, 10, 12 weeks after I got there, they were relocated out to, where did they go? I think, I don't know whether they went down to Kamau. Anyway, they packed up and left. For better hunting ground. Also, the River Division 53 eventually, a couple of squadrons of boats there moved out toward Tay Ninh. So, I think there was a sense that things were fairly quiet, calm, relatively speaking. Late in the year, there started to be some reports about reports coming in about movements out of Cambodia. What was it? The 88 Bravo Regiment of North Vietnamese, for example, were reported to be getting ready to make a move into the province to the north. Into Dinh Tung. So there, at that point, there was no significant. In fact, there may not have been any North Vietnamese presence in the province. It was all VC. That changed as my tour went on. Things got a little bit more active.
All right. Now after this first week. Been introduced kind of a crash course in at least the geography and some of the folks that you'd have to be working with. Baldwin leaves, he goes back to the United States, and you're there to take on your job. G- given the independence of, or that was typical of Nilo, everyone that I've spoken with, the Nilos that I've spoken with, kind of did things differently. Individual personalities and things like that would largely direct, I think, a lot of the way they would approach it. How did you seek to approach your job there? I mean, again, with all this independence, with all of these contacts, with all this freedom, how did you approach it?
Well, I didn't have a routine per se. I didn't want to have a routine. I thought that was a bad idea. So I would on any given day, I'd certainly stop by and see everybody. I'd process message traffic such as it was in the morning and throughout the day, actually. But I would, one morning I might go to the sector brief. Another morning I would go to the 9th Infantry brief, the daily brief, the CG's daily brief. I'd always make a point of stopping by at some point over at the 525 group. Maybe I'd have lunch with them, maybe I'd have supper with them or something like that. But I'd always get around to see everybody as best I could. I'd spend some time out on the boats. I'd go out on the river with the boats. I'd be reactive to anything that I came across that seemed to that seemed to be worth reacting to. I'd try to get information to people, but if somebody tracked me on a Monday, I'd be doing something completely different on Tuesday. One thing that George didn't do a lot of, that I did do a fair amount of, was fly with the air liaison officer. There was an Air Force captain who had an O-1, and he had room in the back seat. I would get up and fly with him, do VR on the province, look around, see what was going on, try and get a sense of things from the air. I do that maybe once, twice a week. So I had no fixed schedule. I had no formal briefing process that I had to that I had to be a briefer. I didn't, for example, the River Division 53, I suppose that had they asked me for a daily briefing, certainly I'd have done a daily briefing for them, but they didn't ask for one, and I didn't volunteer one.
Mm-hmm.
So my schedule was more or less dictated by what was happening at the moment, not by some event planner.
Right, sure. Which again is kind of the nature of this business. You're a bit of a free agent out there,
mm-hmm.
Trying to collect information and relay it from all sides and in all mm-hmm. kinds of different directions.
Right.
For example, say you'd stop by the 525 MI group, listen to a briefing there. Would someone say, okay, Carol, I want to talk to you about this particular issue. There's somebody out here that we'd like for you to get some more information from. Would they point you in a direction in that kind of way?
Yeah, they might do that. That kind of thing would happen. They have some reports of activity somewhere, for example, near a waterway. And it would be, you think your guys can get anything on this? Meaning either the boats or the two networks, we'd swap information where we could, and we'd try to help the other guy out where we could, where we thought we had an asset in position to help out the other guy. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when you would go out, say, on the boats, or you go out with the ALO, and this is something that you would come up with, some sort of intel, or hopefully, or something interesting that may be going on that might be indicative of something else, or you make a contact with someone, this is what you could possibly take back to the 525 or the advisory group or whoever it may have been.
Yeah, and certainly, of course, to the N2 up in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Reports back that way.
Right. Yeah. Well, I know that you've told me that there is no such thing for you as a typical day. Having said that, I'm going to ask you.
What was a typical
day? Well, what would be a typical day for you?
Well, you know, other than probably getting up at around 6 in the morning or 5:30 or something like that, and depending on what was going on, probably racking out at about 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night. Those were the two, probably the two givens, and maybe eating two meals. I don't know. I suppose it would be, you know, up in the morning, over to the at least early on, over to the Victory Hotel for some breakfast and a chat with Bill McNicholas. Anything happened last night that you knew of or whatever? That's sort of an informal update on anything that may have gone on the night before. Then the day would go from there. I'd go down to the office and read traffic that might have come in overnight, and from there it would be sort of free form after that. So I suppose if I could say there was a sort of a typical thing, it would probably be the first 2 hours of the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, it would be, you know, who knows what.
Right. Now, would you be apprised of, for example, what River Division 53 might have been doing? Like, they're going to send a squad out up this waterway at a certain time, and you thought, oof, I'd like to be up there. There's some things going on up there that I'd like to be part of.
Yeah.
So do you contact them like the day before and say, look, give me your schedule so I can see what you're doing so I can hook up with you guys, that kind of thing?
Yeah, they in fact, my office was directly across the building. No hallway or anything. I mean, their desk was right over there, and so yeah, I was aware of what their op sched was, and also the platoon from SEAL Team 2, the same thing. I knew where they were going. If they're going somewhere at night, I'd know where they were going, and I'd know who to go and talk to about, you know, what happened, and basically get a verbal after action report from them.
Right. Obviously, the SEALs wouldn't want you going in with them.
I did go once or twice.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, you've got to tell me about this.
Yeah. It was just simple stuff. We'd go in by boat. There were actually two elements there. I mean, there was SEAL Team 2 platoon. That was 12 guys. And they had a boat support group with them also. So I'd go out with them on the boat, and maybe I'd go ashore with them, or maybe I wouldn't, but they didn't seem to mind my tagging along. We never engaged, so, you know, there was never, my presence didn't cause them a problem.
Right.
I imagine if it did, it would have been the last time I had ever been with them, but... No, I was quite friendly with the guys. In fact, I've stayed in touch with the XO of that platoon for a long, long time now. I got out with them a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And these guys were just kind of out snooping and pooping.
Yeah, pretty much that's what it was. I would guess in the probably 12 weeks that they were there, I think they actually engaged probably no more.
And then they'd come back, and you'd ask for some sort of brief, informal kind of thing.
Yeah, what did you find? What did you see?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing.
Anything of any significance that you can recall?
Mm-hmm. There was an island right off the river, or in the river right off the base. A fairly large island, inhabited, mostly fishing community and whatnot. Anytime the SEAL support boat left the pier, a green flare would go off from the island. There was somebody out there that was tracking the island, or that was tracking activity on the base. And so one night, some intel had been developed about who might be doing this. You know, might have an idea who was doing this. They set off separately a good bit before in another boat to go around to the south side of the island to wait until well after dark, at which point the Mike boat would leave the pier and try and get in position to see where the green flare was being fired from to see if they could put a stop to it. And they did. They got the guy who actually was firing off the green flare and brought him back in. There was a big stink got raised over it because the guy was apparently some sort of an official. That pretty quickly became a political incident, I think, that I all of a sudden was not involved in. So
that's really interesting.
Yeah.
What was the population of this community on the island?
It was pretty substantial. Mito itself, I guess, you know, pre-war Mito was maybe, I don't know, 30,000 people or 20,000 people. It was a good size, pretty good size city. So this was a fairly decent population out on this island. It was a pretty big island, and as I say, it was, I don't know, just a couple hundred yards across from the base. So maybe a little farther than that.
So do you have any idea what became of this situation?
No, I don't. I know an investigator was sent down from Saigon. Actually, the intel for this had been developed by, as I recall, by the 525th MI group, and someone through the 525. The case officer was a fellow named Don Merkel. I remember Don Merkel. He had previously been a Los Angeles city cop. He was a captain, Army captain. And I know Don got hauled in at one point for some questioning over this whole thing, and then I never heard anything further about it.
So. That's really interesting. Now, of course, you're dealing with intel here, down here in the Delta. And everything that moves and doesn't move is a source of intel potentially, and you're dealing with all these moving parts, not just the enemy and the local population, but also dealing with the Americans there. Lots of moving parts there as well. You mentioned that the CIA, of course, had a presence or a strong presence in Mito. What can you tell me about your interaction with the CIA as it concerned you as a NILO?
I pretty quickly established a very good working relationship with them. I a much better one, I think, than George had prior to me. And I don't know why, I don't know how really that happened. I suppose it started out through Al Huey, was the PRU advisor. The station chief was a fellow by the name of Ian Sammers, and Ian's son was in the Navy. So he was an officer in the Navy. And so Ian was a much older guy. He'd been a Jedburg. I don't know, we just established a really good relationship, and then one of the other case officers there was a fellow named John Tingle, and John was from Mississippi, and he found out I'd gone to Georgia Tech. He said, "Oh, another Southern boy." So anyway, we got along just fine. We got along famously, to the point where John actually John was actually sharing draft reports with me of some of this stuff, which was mostly political intelligence and economic intelligence. I don't think he was doing that on a quid pro quo basis, but just to have somebody else to take a look at it. When eventually the Victory Hotel shut down, when the Naval Support Activity Detachment closed down to the point where there were only about eight people on the advisory group, maintenance advisory group to the Vietnamese Navy there, and everything was closed down except for the Navy base itself, there was some question as to where I was going to live, and they actually offered me space on the compound. I talked it over actually with with Paul Keast, and he was the chief of the collection branch in Saigon, and I thought, you know, this would be great, but there'd be no guarantee that whoever relieved me would get the same entree. So we never did it. It's probably a good thing we didn't.
Why do you say that?
Because I maintained, I think the position would have lost a tremendous amount of independence if that had happened. You know, it was fine to come back and forth through the gate and whatnot, and you know, have dinner with him or whatever. But it was quite another thing to you know, to feel somehow bound to them, beholden to them.
Right.
For a place to stay.
Right, right. I can certainly understand that.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned that one of these gentlemen would share political and economic intel with you. What do you mean by political and economic intel?
Well, he was writing, he was putting together these really massive reports. I mean, these are not, you know, these are not two paragraph or three paragraph summaries. These read like 15, 20 page analyses of rice trafficking activities and how the market for consumer goods was working in Kaibei Province, and that gave a view of that provided some insight into the fact that there was sort of a dual economy going there. So it was really the political element of the VC that he was trying to track and map. He had much less concern about the military side of it. It was interesting reading, and I suppose all those reports ended up somewhere up in Saigon.
Now, did you find that the intel that they would provide for you to be good intel?
Well, actually, a lot of stuff came through the PRU, the Provincial Reconnaissance Unit, and that tended to be, you know, if it was reliable 20-30% of the time, if it was useful 20-30% of the time, that was a lot. But the PRU were, you know, kind of a motley crew, to say the least, and they really were a motley crew.
I want you to explain that to me. What do you mean by that?
They were, at least in Mito, I don't know whether it was that way elsewhere, they were all Hmongs, ethnic Chinese out of Cholon. The officer in charge, on the other hand, was a regular Vietnamese Army officer, and was not very well liked. They lived in a compound, or they lived in a barracks that was on the compound that we call Embassy House was in, and so it was pretty tight quarters, but that's where they were. They were someone described them to me once, you know, just a bunch of criminals that were swept up out of Cholon, and this was an alternative to going to prison. They did not like the discipline that the army captain tried to impose on them. They were kind of scary at times. They really were kind of scary at times. They did a lot of night operations, they always managed to find contact somewhere. I'm not quite sure. I'm not quite sure how legit any of that contact was, but just to give you an idea of why they were thugs, they went out for what was supposed to be the Vietnamese Army captain's last assignment with them. He was being transferred someplace else, and it turned out to be his last assignment. There were very few shots fired, and he was the only one that was hit. But that was how they settled their differences with him.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. So.
Now, how were they going out? Were they going out on foot? Were they going out in boats? How were they doing this?
For the most part, they would go out on a truck somewhere, and they'd go in from go in off a road. They did go in off boat occasionally. Sometimes, very rarely the U.S. transport them. They were transported, for the most part, by the Vietnamese Navy when they went in by boat. The advisor normally went with them. I really have to hand it to Al Huey for he certainly had his courage screwed on pretty tightly to go in with them sometimes when he did. But he was a trainer with them. I mean, he was their advisor. And Al left and was replaced eventually by an Army captain, Green Beret, who had just come off an 18 assignment.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was an interesting group.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody else. I haven't spoken to any of the other Nihilos about what their experiences were with the PRU. But through the relationship that I had established with the folks at Embassy and with Al, I did get a pretty good look at them, and I was suitably cautious.
I would imagine so. This is the first I've heard of this part of the project there,
yeah.
So it's really interesting.
Yeah.
You also mentioned that there's a Phoenix office
mm-hmm.
Down in Mito. For those who aren't familiar with the Phoenix program, can you describe it for me, please, before you go into your relation with the folks at Phoenix?
Well, it was I think the basis for it was sort of a an amnesty get-out-of-jail-free kind of a program. You know, you could turn yourself in. If you're a VC, you could turn yourself in, and if you provided whatever information you had about all the things that you'd done as a VC, all would be forgiven. You'd be you'd essentially be retrained into sort of given a new life, if you will. Maybe kind of like a witness protection program for the VC. That might be one way of looking at it. And so that I, at least I understood, was the was one part of it. Another part of it had to do with, and this came under CORDS, I think, which was essentially a redevelopment program, kind of an urban, not an urban, but a rural renewal program that somehow was tied into this process of, bringing in bringing in the VC off the fold, into the fold, and establishing establishing communities under the government. So that at least is my understanding of what it was supposed to be or what it was. What I was getting from Phoenix was, you know, when if an individual came in that seemed interesting from a standpoint of you know, what they had done and what they claimed to know, it would be good to talk to that person and see if we couldn't develop something that might be actionable for Navy. So that's what I did.
All right, now the working in the Delta as you did, obviously, like you say, VC strength is down, and one of the aspects of working in the Delta, as I understand it, during that time, 1969, 1970, following Tet and all of that, was working on interdiction of food, interdiction of weapons, even of intel, I guess, in your case, and one of the major efforts unleashed, I guess, by the Navy was Sea Lords.
Uh-huh.
Now, were you there for a portion of this overall effort. Can you describe the purpose of Sea Lords and then your role in it?
Well, the waterways, back up, the road system there, for the most part, was pretty primitive, and so the waterways were the principal vehicles of, you know, or routes of commerce. And if anything were, if logistics were to flow, it would be on the waterways. And so if there were to be, if units were to be supplied, for example, goods would flow on the waterways, and so the interdiction program was designed to stop that, looking for any river crossings, transfer points where goods might go from one means of transport to, say, to the water, and that was the principal Sea Lord's objective, I think, was to interdict that sort of commerce in that way. And the material, any material, for example, that would have come out of would have come down the trail and into Cambodia, the parrot's nest, or the parrot's beak, and the elephant's nest, and the crow's nest, or whatever, to get down at least into the Delta would have to move down across the Plain of Reeds, across the Grand Canal, and make its way down across the Mekong, which is, as I say, had several branches that made up the Delta there. So there would be lots of opportunities to block transport on the waterways. I don't know that there was that much movement of stuff while I was there.
And what role would you play in this?
Well, it would be to try and again through any of these sources that were available to me, you know, get a sense of was there any motion, movement of goods, and from the VRs, were there any obvious signs on the ground that this was a trail for movement. Agent reports would come in the same way. One of the things that I would always get from the two agent networks were reports of massive movements of goods, which you know, there's no way that somebody's going to move 25 tons of 82 millimeter mortar rounds or something like that overnight from here to there and on foot, you know, things like that.
And these are the kind of reports you were getting?
Yeah, I would frequently get reports like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you just know that
Now, you've talked about these two agent groups that you'd be working with. Can you describe them for me?
To the best of my knowledge, and my knowledge didn't go that very deep into the agent groups because, again, I was just dealing with the principal agents.
Mm-hmm.
They were networks that had been established essentially by the Vietnamese Navy and two staff. I was not involved in any payments to these, via the two principal agents. That was all handled on the Vietnamese Navy side. So, I had a slush fund, but it wasn't to pay these two networks. They apparently had been vouched for in some fashion through the COM-NAV-4V N2. I really don't know. Many of the reports, as I say, were of that moving 25 tons of stuff overnight. On the other hand, there were some good actionable things. Or at least certainly reports that were very credible and warranted follow-up.
Mm-hmm. So. Why do you suspect they would come up with these whoppers of intel? Were they getting paid? And maybe you don't even know this.
Yeah.
But were they getting paid on the amount of information? Okay, I come in with info that I think you're going to pay me for. And I deliver it, and the bigger it is, the better it sounds, the more I make. How did that work, or are you privy to that?
Yeah, I wasn't privy to that, but I think that's probably what was going on. I imagine they were being paid on a per report basis, if
mm-hmm.
nothing else. I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
as I say, they did occasionally come up with some actionable stuff.
Let me ask you another question you may not know the answer to, since I'm doing that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Working through the two principal agents, and the Vietnamese Navy would pay the two principal agents, would the money then go back to others in the network? Would it filter down through the rest who are working to provide this information? Or do you suspect that it stayed there at the two who were providing the information? Do you have any idea how that would have worked?
I don't know. I have no idea. I would suspect that it was intended that it would, trickle down. But again, I don't know.
Right, right. All right, well, why don't we stop there for today, Ken?
Okay.
This is Kelly Krieger continuing an oral history interview with Captain Dave Carroll. Today is 14 March 2012. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Captain Carroll is joining me by telephone again from his home in Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey. Okay, Captain Carroll, the last time we spoke, you were giving me a description of your job there as a Nilo and Mito, the individuals you would meet, the overall setup, the passing of intel, and kind of the general dynamic of what it was like to be a Nilo in Mito. One of the things I wanted to talk about was Operation Brightlight today, if we could. Can you tell me the scope and nature of the Brightlight operations, and then the one in particular which you were involved?
Right. Well, bright light was a code word for anything involving U.S. POWs or potential POW ops. And let's see, in November of 69, let me back up a little bit. If there were any indication, any credible indication of U.S. POW sightings or reports or whatever, any message traffic that went out, first of all, was flagged with word bright light to bring it to immediate attention, and if there were any logistical matters that could expedite reacting to anything developed. Just simply invoking the term bright light would get you a helicopter. It would get you, you know, virtually anything you needed to at least take the next step with regard to whatever information you had. In November of 69, the Third Coastal Zone intelligence officer, Lieutenant Commander Jack Graff, and an Air Force pilot by the name of John Blight, I believe it was, were shot down off the coast in the province just south of me, south of Ventre. And they were flying a Mohawk, and they were on what I understand was just a routine VR, visual reconnaissance in the area. They were observed going down by a ship offshore that I think they were also doing some spotting work for, and they were seen to be snatched as soon as they parachuted down. So for quite a while over that period, or following November, there were all sorts of periodic reports of one or two Caucasians, one tall, one short. Jack was the shorter one being seen, and nothing, it seems, came of any of those reports until, let's see, this would have been in June, or maybe it was in May, I don't recall, of 1970. One of my two principal agents came in with what appeared to be a very credible report of a sighting and a location, and so I immediately got, you know, traffic off up to COMNAV-4V on that, and got an immediate response back from the NSU shop up there, from Paul Keith's group, and over a period of about 4 days, I suppose, 4 or 5 days, I had some specific targeting that came out from COMNAV-4V to pass on to the principal agent for further, you know, for further collection. In the meantime, there was an IR mission flown over the area where the agent had reported there was the campsite where two were being held. And that turned up to be a hot spot, indicating that, in fact, there's been activity there above background. So it appears that that added some credibility to the report. A platoon from SEAL Team 1, which was based not too terribly far away, ultimately was tasked with the mission to go in and try and liberate anybody who was there. My relief was on board at that point, Don Herod, and I remember just before I left MITO, just before I was transferred back to the States, he and I commandeered a helicopter using the bright light code word to do so, and flew down to meet with Tom Boyan, was his name, the officer in charge of One, go over what intel I had developed through the agent. Certainly, he was getting feed from others as well. And he and his leading petty officer Lenton did a VR in the area as well. You know, shortly after I got there and spoke with him, the two of them flew off the helicopter and VR'd the area, which wasn't too terribly far away from them, perhaps maybe 20, 25 kilometers. I ended up leaving MITO actually that day to check out through Saigon and go back, report back to Coronado, which is what my orders had been changed to make a stop off in Coronado before going to my next duty assignment in Norfolk. That was the that's sort of an overview of what happened. it wasn't without some problems developing, trying to develop further intel following the initial report. The S2 in Ventrae, an Army captain whose name I remember but shall remain nameless, was particularly put out by the idea that the Navy guy up in Mito was running an asset in what he considered his area.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one or two nasty phone conversations with him. Passed this on, of course, to Saigon, and was told simply to ignore the guy and just, you know, continue as you're going. But when I got back to, got into San Diego, or into Coronado, after the trip back, I was met by Master Chief Al Huey. I mentioned him earlier. He was the TRU advisor from SEAL Team 1. And Al told me that the rescue attempt came up with a dry hole. So that was my experience with one solid experience as part of a Bright Light op. Interestingly, the principal agent who developed this information had just a short time previously developed something on an ambush site up to the north of me, actually up in Three Corps, along one of the rivers there. I can't remember which one it was, the Basak or whatever. And I had passed that on up to Vanilo and Mukwa, and a fellow named John Gee, and that turned out to be very actionable intel. A counter ambush was set and was very successful. So, the report had some creds, unlike some of the earlier reporting that I had gotten from out of the network. So, it lent credence to the whole narrative that unfolded.
Right.
So we found out later, John White was the last TW to be released by the VC in 1973, I believe. And I guess it was found out during his debrief and I guess some additional spade work that was done over the years that, in fact, Jack had been killed trying to escape. So at the time, I don't know if there, in fact, were two PWs or not.
How is it that you come across this intel? Just kind of out of the blue? Is it something you're looking for because you knew that they had gone down in the Mohawk and they could possibly be out there? Are you putting feelers out for that? Or is it just stuff that kind of comes in, you look at it, decipher it, and see what might be useful? How does that come in?
Well, the PA, the principal agents, knew that anything regarding USPWs was a high priority action item for them to be reporting in. And it, at least to me, reporting into me, there was very little of that. So it's not a, in my mind, it was not a priority that they abused to get whatever it was they got in the way of compensation for the reporting that they did.
Mm-hmm.
So when it did come in, and it came in fairly detailed with respect to the location certainly the description, the physical description of the two, of course that was pretty well known, I guess, but coming in from him, I don't know who his sources actually were, but coming in through him and following the actionable stuff that had been reported just a short time previously, certainly I gave it some credence, and I've subsequently learned as part of the whole NILA reunion program that we have going now that Pete Decker and some others have been very active in putting together and keeping alive, that there were a number of things going on over that period of 6 or 7 months that Jack and John were down to try and do a recovery. I was just not aware of them. Certainly the nature of any ops to try and recover was such that me up in Mito, I had no need to know. So certainly wasn't aware of anything.
Mm-hmm. Now, once you tag this bright light and it gets more and more attention, are you tasked with continuing to develop the information, the intel,
right,
the contacts?
Yeah.
What do you do in terms of continuing to develop this intel to try to help out the overall operation?
Well, the main thing that I did was try and get the PA to report more and more detailed information. What came in initially was a sort of a general description of an area where the two were reported to be held. So what I tried to get from him was more detail. How many people were there? What was the OB there? Were they in a cage? Were they tied up? Were they how were the two being held? What kind of security was there? Things of that sort that would be of use to anybody attempting to do a recovery.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there were probably, and this really is a guess at this point, I really just don't recall, there were at least probably three iterations of reports following the initial report. In other words, a couple of more taskings to him to develop further information. That was, as I recall, that's the way it went.
Right. Okay, now you also mentioned that this is about the time that you're due to rotate back to the States.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You've got a replacement, someone who's going to relieve you as Nilo and Mito. You talked about the person you were replacing, George, I believe his name was.
Mm-hmm. George Baldwin.
Yes, George Baldwin. What did you do when this new Nilo comes down to you to prepare him for his role down there in the Delta? Take me through your effort to prepare this replacement for you before you rotate back.
Well, it turned out to be a pretty easy job. I knew the guy. I'd been working with him for several months already. Don was attached to the 117 staff out at Dongtam, just about 10 k's out to the west of Mito. And so I saw him fairly regularly. He wanted the job. I mean, he tried to, he made it known that when I had left, he wanted to be in Mito. And we had done a number of things together over the previous couple of months. So he had a fairly good idea of what the job entailed already when he came in. What he didn't necessarily have was he didn't have the contacts that I had. And so it was just, for the most part, a process of introducing him to the players that he hadn't already met, or if he had already met them, basically updating them on the kind of things that we did. So it turned out to be a very easy transition in my mind. My guess is that when he took over the position, he didn't feel kind of lost and out there all by himself.
But, right. Now, did you take him through the same kind of process that Baldwin took you through, driving around in jeeps, meeting different people, taking it to different districts and different villages, and meeting the different contacts? Is that the same process for you?
Yeah, pretty much the same. Through his position on the staff at 117, he had met a number of folks already. So, he had some uh, he already had some established contacts himself. The difference for him was going to be, you know, going from a fairly substantial staff, I guess, that they had out there at Doncan to this post that what with the Vietnamization program and the transfer of all the boats to the Vietnamese and whatnot had dwindled down to the point where we were only about a dozen people in NITO, a dozen Navy people in NITO, and he would be the only commissioned officer there. Not that he would have any command responsibilities, but the support activity function that remained there was a warrant officer, and eight or nine mechanics and whatnot to help maintain the boats and train the Vietnamese on boat maintenance. So he was going from a staff that had a quite senior captain on it, as well as the intelligence, an N2 above him, to being quite independent, pretty much by himself. In that sense, he probably went into a bit more of a void than I did.
Right.
Started. At least when I was there, there was a fairly large group of folks to start.
Was there anything that you took him through, trained him on, told him about, that you thought, well, I wish George Baldwin had told me about this or had explained this to me? Was there anything in particular that you added in addition to what Baldwin gave you?
I guess the only thing was the process of the bright light, and that didn't happen with George because nothing came up, I guess, on his watch that involved that. Now, Don came in right as that was unfolding.
All right, as your time winds down there in Mito and time is rapidly approaching to leave, do you take time to look back on the year that you spent there as Nilo? Do you assess your effectiveness? Do you look back and say, this was a good time? This was something that I made a positive difference. I like my performance here. Did you look back on it with misgivings at all? How did you assess your year there before you left?
I'd say I was, I don't know that I ever sat down, you know, while I was there and was perhaps that introspective, but and certainly as I look at it now might be different than I would have looked at it in 1970. I thought I made a positive impact. I was pleased with what I did. I think I did the right thing. I don't think I did any wrong things. I feel that I did what was expected of me.
All right, now, you're coming home. Take me through the process by which you leave Mito and make your way back to the United States.
Well, Don drove me up to Saigon and dropped me off at the billet that we had for Nilo's coming in and out of town. And I went over to ComNav for the headquarters and began the checkout process. That's all kind of a blur. I don't remember anything very specific about that. What I do recall, though, and this was this was rather interesting, the day that I got to Saigon, which was the day before I left the country, the staff at ComNav would be the N2 staff. Was holding a going-away party for, a sort of a hail and farewell for the guys that were leaving the staff and the Saigon Bay staff. And as kind of an afterthought, I was invited to this. And so I, you know, I felt kind of like the orphan, because, you know, they're all patting each other on the back on what a great staff job they did, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm sitting there at wherever it was, the Meyer Court, or I can't remember which hotel it was in. They're getting up and they're making their little speeches, and nobody asked me anything. So I felt kind of left out from the process, quite frankly, and was a little bit bitter about it.
Is that right?
I mentioned that to someone. I said, you know, saying like, here I'm out in the field. I'm feeding into you guys for a year. You throw this going away party at the same time I'm going. You don't even have a thank you. And I guess it was maybe, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 months later, I was sent the plaque from headquarters. But the one thing that was kind of funny, I've mentioned his name before, Paul Keast, Commander Paul Keast, who was the chief of the collections branch, and he's the one that all Annihilos really reported into. I had been on R&R, I guess, about maybe 10 weeks prior or 12 weeks prior to Deros. I had delayed on that to meet my wife in Hawaii. Didn't want to do it too early and then feel really bad for the next, you know,
sure,
8 months or something like that. And one of the things that I brought back from, I brought two things back from Hawaii. I'll go into the second one in a second. The first was a box of instant, it was a dry mix to make a whiskey sour. Okay. And when I came back through Saigon after going on R&R, I happened to mention this to Keith. And when I get ready to leave to go back home, I still had my box of instant mix, and I mentioned that to him, or he asked me about it, I guess. What did you do with that stuff? I said, oh, I still got it. He said, great, bring it on the plane, I'll bring a bottle, and we'll, because we were going back on the same flight. So we did. We had whiskey sours on it. on a Pan Am flight, which is kind of funny. But anyway, once I got checked out, we flew out from Tonsina through Yokota. We went from Yokota to Anchorage. And two things about that trip. First of all, I had been told that Yokota had a wonderful camera shop, the Air Force Base there. And Yokota had a wonderful camera shop in the transient terminal. And I had a whole list of stuff that I wanted to buy. And I had all this money in my interest-bearing Chase checking account that I contributed into over the year. And I got off the plane pretty quickly and got to the camera shop and took out my list, and I had a whole pile of stuff on the counter, and then took out my checkbook and was told they don't take checks from transients. So all of my camera equipment ultimately became a bedroom suite and a coffee table and two end tables and two other things that my wife had some plans on. But our stop in Anchorage was an eye-opener. We got there at about, I don't know, maybe 5:30 in the morning. Nothing was open. And one thing that happened that really soured me very much about the return. As we got off the plane, it was officers over here, enlisted over here, and the Alaska State Patrol did a body search on all the enlisted as they came to the country.
Is that right?
And I'm saying to myself, welcome home. You know, really great. I might have expected some scene, coming through the airport in San Francisco after we got from Clark over to San Francisco. But, I mean, that sight of everybody being lined up and searched. I don't know if that was a routine thing or not, but it certainly has left a bad taste in my mouth.
Now, is it something that the U.S. military had ordered, or was it just the Alaska State Police decided it was something that had to be done?
I have no idea. I think my guess is it was probably just the Alaska State Police.
Hmm.
I don't know.
So, right.
Yeah, really, really sour. Anyway, I got once we got back on the plane, we flew into Clark, and there were several people on the flight with me that were going to San Diego that I knew. John Vincent, who was an aloe up in Tres Coups, was being met by his wife there. John was from Cholo, Arizona. Anyway, his wife, you know, was there to meet him. He was from the West Coast anyway. And there were two other guys. I don't recall who they were. Anyway, we all made our way over to San Francisco, the airport, and got on Poor Sailors Airline and flew down to San Diego, where they were met by their wives. Just kind of standing there with two bags. I guess it was John and his wife said, here, we'll drop you off at the BOQ. Because my orders had been changed at the last minute, ordering me back through Coronado for debriefing. Otherwise, I would have gone directly from San Francisco to Fort Myers, which is where my wife was. So they dropped me off at the BOQ, and that's when I got hooked up with Al. Info on the op that had gone down. I guess it was actually just the day before. Come up with a dry haul. So, let's see, the following day, there was one incident, two incidents actually that evening after this height. I was up in one of the top decks in the BOQ at Coronado, which is a fairly tall building right there on the Strand. And I got up to my room and basically flopped down on the rack, and there was a fairly substantial earth tremor out in the valley, out in the desert somewhere. And the room moved. My first thought was, I'm going to die. first night back. Building's going to collapse. I'm going to die. So I made my way down to the bar. The elevators weren't working. I was like up on the 10th or 12th floor, pretty high up. I went into the bar and had a beer, really jet lagged out, kind of whacked out, and decided I would go over to the Oak Club and have dinner. Oak Club was just a short walk away, and I was in the uniform that I've been traveling in, and I got over to the club, and they weren't going to let me eat because I didn't have the uniform the day on. And I raised a big stink about it, and finally the club manager said, yeah, fine. So I had something to eat. But the following day, I went over to check in where I was supposed to be meeting the guy who was running the Nilo training program at that time. And we talked a little bit about the bright light and a few other things. I met a couple of the guys who were in the class who would be going over, I guess, later on that year, and spoke to them briefly. And then he said, I think it was still an Army major who was running the program. He said, I'm not really sure why they had you come back here. I'll sign you out. Why don't you go on home? So I did. I got my way up to the airport, got to the airport, got booked on a flight, standby. They put me on standby on a flight that was going into Atlanta via Dallas. And the flight crew was very good. They moved me up in first class, which I thought was quite nice, on the flight to Dallas. And they told me, you're going to have to get off the plane in Dallas. We don't know if there's going to be, if the seat's going to still be available for you. And so actually, when we got to Dallas, I just stayed in the seat, worked out fine, got to Atlanta, and then managed to get a flight from Atlanta to Tampa. And then in Tampa, I got on a small six-seater commuter flight that was going down to Fort Myers. Meanwhile, I called my wife from Atlanta to tell her that I was coming, I was on my way and whatnot, and she met me at the airport, and she didn't recognize me. I'd grown a mustache since R&R, and she said, I really don't recognize you with that mustache on. Looked like a Mexican cab driver, so shave it off. So I eventually did a couple days later. So that was the trip home. you know, I've got to say the folks on the airlines on the trip from San Diego back to Fort Myers were wonderful. I was traveling in uniform. I had to travel in uniform at that time if you're flying Space A. It wasn't at all like the like the greeting in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about this this initial time back, if you can, Captain. You've been away for a year. You're largely left on your own to run wild, if you will, as a Nilo down in Three Corps in Vietnam. Four Corps in Vietnam, excuse me. And now you've come back to the United States. Your first experience is, of course, there in Japan. They say no checks from transits.
Yeah.
Then your next stop is Anchorage, Alaska, where they're pulling the enlisted men off the plane and searching them for contraband, I would assume.
Uh-huh.
Then you go and then you find yourself in Coronado, and you're told that you can't go to the officers' club because of, you know, you're not dressed properly.
Uh-huh.
It would seem to me that it would be a difficult adjustment going from the kind of freedom that you enjoyed as a Nilo in Vietnam compared to the rules and regulations of not just everyday life in the Navy, but everyday life in general in the United States. Did you have any sort of difficulty adjusting to this kind of change?
No, I really didn't. We had, my wife and I had roughly, I guess it was probably 2 weeks in Florida before I had to report into my next duty station. We just had a real, really good time. You know, it was great to be home. Everybody was friendly. I mean, Fort Myers that time pretty conservative. So you know, there was you know, nobody spat at me or anything like that. You know, I mean, the people that were friends of my mother-in-law's and friends of my mother, who also lived a little bit north of there, you know, they were very welcoming, and I sort of decompressed, I think, pretty well. My wife and I kind of decompressed pretty well. She was pregnant at that point after the after R&R, and so we took our time. Driving up to Norfolk, which is where my next duty station was, and I don't know. I didn't have any difficulty. I didn't feel any difficulty, and I didn't regret anything. I didn't feel ostracized. I just felt like I had sort of drifted back into drifted back into society as it was. Now, when I got up to Norfolk, my assignment there was the N-21 at Commander Anti-Submarine Warfare Force Atlantic, so I was moving into a structured environment. Clearly,
right,
it was a staff job. The N-2, Commander Hal Sachs, was a surface warfare officer. He'd been CO of a destroyer, been out on Yankee Station with the destroyer. I mean, he was a veteran. He was a good boss. I mean, he was a really good boss. He ran a good shop, I thought. The other junior officers that were that made up the intelligence watch there were all quite recently out of OCS. They were ensigns, and there was one JG. I think there were four of them all together, as I remember. And so, I mean, they'd not seen shipboard duty as I had. They certainly hadn't been to Vietnam like I had. And so I came in, you know, kind of with some status, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
At least within the Intel shop. And the transition there was pretty straightforward, at least initially. I had a day job. I was not standing the Intel watch. And it was only when I decided that I was going back to grad school that I was put into the regular rotation of the Intel watch. So that transition was not particularly difficult.
Mm-hmm. You say you went to grad school. What were you going? Where did you go, and what was your focus?
I went back to Georgia Tech. In the chemistry department for PhD in chemistry. So.
And I should ask you, did you complete your PhD in chemistry?
Yeah. Right.
Very good. So doctor as well as captain.
Yeah.
U.S. Navy retired.
Yeah.
Well, give me a quick thumbnail sketch of the rest of your career there in the Navy. Obviously, you retired during your captain. What was the rest of your career like? What were your stations?
I started out with the... I was an 1100 on active duty, and I had requested restricted line transfer to 1630. Actually, the first time was while I was in ILO, and the second time was while I was on the staff at ASW Foreland. Two things were happening at that point. I mean, first of all, the officer corps was shrinking following Vietnam, or as Vietnam wound down. And second of all, there were quite a few 1355 AIs that were also going for restricted line transfer from the 1355 the AIs transferred to 1635 or augmentation to 1630. So there was no opportunity. And had I gotten the restricted line transfer to 1630, I would not have gone into grad school. I would have stayed on active duty.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I as soon as I got to Tech, I hooked up with a surface warfare unit out of the Navy Marine Corps Reserve Center. It was right there on the Georgia Tech campus, and started drilling there. Then eventually, my restricted line transfer of 1105 to 1635 came in, and I got hooked up with an Intel unit in Atlanta. I was recalled in 73 to do for Operation Homecoming. I spent 6 or 8 weeks, I guess it was, up at the Naval Hospital in Portsmouth, debriefing as they came out of Hanoi. We moved eventually up to New Jersey. I got hooked up with reserve units up here. Then eventually took an assignment with an Intel slot with Naval Special Warfare Support Unit up here, and spent a good deal of time there. From there, ended up commanding a Naval Intelligence Support Center unit, spent some time on a staff. My next assignment was commanding officer of the Naval Investigative Service Unit in Manhattan, then I spent some time on staff at Willow Grove, and at that point put in my papers. That was that. So that's it in a nutshell.
One of the things that cropped up, of course, that got my attention was you were being part of the debriefing effort
mm-hmm.
as part of Operation Homecoming, of course, the POW release coming back to the United States. One, how did you land that? I'll ask you the first question. How did you land that job?
A call had been put out, I don't recall when, maybe it was in 1971 or something like that. Would you be interested? And it was just a general interest question. And I responded yes. And then never thought anything about it. And then all of a sudden get the call. When did I get the call? In February, I guess it was, of 73. Can you come up here to the Naval Hospital in Portsmouth? The person who was running the homecoming program there was I think it was the executive officer at what used to be called FICLAN, Fleet Intelligence Center Atlantic, named Sid Beaver. And I know he had culled through a bunch of records of people, and he chose who he wanted, for the most part, to do this. I guess whatever he saw about what I was doing as an ILO, I suppose, made sense to him, and that's why I was asked if I could come up. And I said yes, made arrangements with my thesis advisor to be away for a while, put some research on hold, and went up to Norfolk, or to Portsmouth.
All right, now, once you arrive there, you're going to be debriefing the prisoners of war on their experiences, any sort of intel that you can garner from that, et cetera. What kind of information are you specifically looking for in these debriefings?
Well, I was assigned to someone who went down during the Christmas bombing. 72. So he had actually not been PW for much more than 4 months or something like that by the time he came out. So he was one of the last ones to be released because, you know, they came out in inverse date order. And, or in date order. And, but we were always after, two things, or at least one thing. Who did you see? Who did you have contact with? Who were Americans? Who? What names did you hear? And so it was always a that was something that we were always after. Now, the first group to come out, in fact, held their first press conference the day after I arrived at the hospital, and that was Admiral Benton. First one, and I remember going to that press conference, sitting in the back of the room there at the hospital, just being really impressed with the way he managed that press conference. All the guys were lined up at a desk, at a long table, in front of the press, and Admiral Dent was in the center, and he basically commanded the whole process with opening statements, and then. Various of the guys also made brief statements as well before it was actually opened up to the press for questions. But that business of who did you see, where did you see them, when did you see them, was thing number one, to try and find out who was alive in the system at any point.
Now, you're assigned to just this one person. Okay. Now, you want to get these names first and foremost from this individual.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, he wasn't there for all that long compared to some of the others who had been there.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Denton and Stockdale and the rest had been there for quite a while. How many times do you question him about this? And are there, for instance, if you ask him today, what kind of names do you remember the Americans that you saw or that you heard of, et cetera? If he has a list of, say, 50 today, would you be interested in going back to him the next day or the day after and say, okay, give me this list again and see if there's anyone else who would come to his mind? How would you approach that?
No, I don't recall doing that. I mean, we went over it first. By the time he, when he was shot down, he was shot down by MiG-17 cannon fire. He really had a rough time with the rest of the squadron over that. He had been by that point. I think everybody had been consolidated, everybody that the North admitted that they had been consolidated. So he was, he was basically dumped in with, you know, whatever it was, 524 other guys, or whatever it eventually became. So he really was not a source of any information for that. Really, the only information that that he had of any sort really was how he was taken down, dogfight, and which was, I suppose, I guess, of some intel value, in a sense, to what our what our debriefing side of the program was all about. Certainly, it was of value to the aviation community, and how he was passed through the system from pickup to when he eventually ended up in Long Island. So that was really it. I mean, he had virtually nothing else to contribute.
What was his mental state?
He was assigned to CAECO from a casualty assistance coordinator, I guess that's what that was short for, who I thought was kind of merciless on him about being shot down by an F-17 by cannon fire.
And what kind of a plane was he flying?
He was flying an F-4.
F-4, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
What was his mental state when you were dealing with him?
He was pretty happy-go-lucky sort of guy. He was married. I met the wife who was in and out of the hospital. He was from up here in New Jersey, and now, you know, for the life of me, I can't recall his name. It'll probably come to me at some point.
Sure.
But he was from down at the shore here in New Jersey.
Well, you've got your tour under your belt there, and there's, I think, perhaps some sort of closure with the with your dealing with Operation Homecoming and POWs coming home. What did you think about the way the United States ended that war, its participation in the war, 73?
I don't know. It seemed to me that we sort of bailed, and we set up the, in a sense, we set up the South Vietnamese Army, propped them up, trained them, transported them, supplied them, and then just sort of bailed out. And, you know, I don't know if there was a win, quote, win, unquote, there. I don't know if the preferable end game would have been just like Korea right now, you know, or just like it was when everything started in 64, north and south. A communist aligned and a Western aligned government, one in the north, one in the south. I'm ambivalent about it, but yet at the same time, I'm left with a sense that we sort of cut and left them hanging.
Well, I've got just a couple more questions for you, Captain, and I know that you're on a schedule today. The first one is, as you look back on your experiences in Vietnam, what do you think, or how do you think the war most affected your life, your experiences in the war most affected your life?
It certainly gave me a better global outlook on politics, I guess, or what politics can lead to. Because of the nature of the job, gave me, I think, an ability to deal with responsibility probably better than say any other assignment would have. I mean, the idea that, you know, here I am, 25 years old, something like that, being entrusted to go out and do what I think had to be done without a whole lot of supervision, recognizing that I'd be answerable for what I did. That sort of freedom to do that. The freedom to do that is one thing. To do that successfully is also to develop the sense of responsibility for your actions once you've done them. And that I guess is probably the main thing that I got from that. You know, what you do has consequences. No matter how much or how little responsibility you're given in any particular situation, what you do will have consequences, and you have to act with that in mind all the time. It gives you a sense of responsibility. So I would say that's what I got.
Very good. Well, my last question for you, Captain, is a very broad one, and it's one that I think we as a society, we as a nation, have struggled with and probably will continue to struggle with over the years, and that is the legacy of the Vietnam War. We say, well, it means this, it means that, we learned these lessons or whatever. I'll ask you straight out, what do you think is the legacy of the Vietnam War?
Afghanistan.
Explain.
In a word. I don't know that politicians learn really anything from it, quite frankly. I just don't have a good feeling that. I think the military has learned a lot from it. They certainly learned a lot about tactics and dealing, perhaps, with insurgencies and that sort of thing. But I don't think geopolitically those responsible for national policy have particularly learned anything from it.
Well, Captain,
I don't know whether that makes me a Republican, a Democrat, or what.
Probably just a concerned citizen who's seen who's seen an awful lot of things continue to be repeated, it seems like.
It does.
Like many of us.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview before we bring it to a close?
No, I'm pleased to have had the chance to do this. I appreciate very much the time that you've taken. And I hope your students will gain something from it. Other than the minimum wage you probably pay them to do the transcribing. I've been a grad student, remember?
Right.
But thank you very much.
Well, I really do appreciate it. It's really been my pleasure.